WRAF in WRAF HD1 Detroit.
Now.
They cannot take our pride.
Yeah, the revolution starts now in your own backyard, in your own hometown. What you can expand when you're fighting out, the revolution starts now.
And welcome to Night Call, starring me, Peter Werby, and my pal, my partner in thought crime, Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, Peter.
Well, I suppose you want your mic on.
The on button.
Yeah.
Again.
Believe it or not, we are going to have a proper introduction next week.
We are.
Yeah.
We have new production.
Oh, this works. I like that, sure. Steve Earle, the revolution starts now in your own backyard, in your own hometown. Don't depend on other people, particularly when those people are politicians. That's what I'd say.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number here at the RIF. And in numerical expression?
313-298-9743.
And if you haven't guessed, we're a talk show. We just do this a little bit here on WRIF, 3 hours on a Sunday night. So we'd like you to be part of it. Jalene and I give our opinions. You give yours. We're pretty strong in our beliefs, and you can do likewise. As long as we are at least fairly civil. I don't demand complete civility.
No. But, sometimes you just can't remain civil.
Yeah, it's always fun to hang up on a few people.
You admit it, Peter.
Yes, right. If you would like to email us, and that's it's a good email address when our lines are filled, which they frequently are. Let me see. I haven't even looked. They are not now because people are wondering, what are we going to talk about? Well, since both Jalene and I are severely ADD, we have absolutely no idea.
We don't plan these things.
And I'm worse than her, and so she has no idea what I'm going to talk about, and neither do I.
Right.
But it'll probably, it'll come up. But anyways.
You know that Regis and Kelly, that's how they fly, too.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. They don't discuss anything before the show.
Wow.
They don't do really show prep. The producers hand them kind of the rundown of the show. We don't even do that. We just have, we just fly.
Yeah. CallTalkYes@Yahoo.com. CallTalkYes@Yahoo.com. And I can't believe I get into these email exchanges. I get so many of them, and there's always a few people that I go, I can't believe this person is writing this. So I write them back, and then they write me back, and then I write them back. And so lately, I figured it out.
I find them highly entertaining.
Yeah, I send them to you. Well, you just read them. I have to write them.
I know.
But I've been letting them have the last word, so I don't care. Hey, it was 40 years ago this last March, 1969, March 1969 in Montreal, that John and Yoko had the Bet In for Peace.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I mean, that seems so quaint now. Well, 40 years, that's almost half a century. That is a long time ago, and people thought and did things a lot differently. But John Lennon, Yoko Ono, got into bed in Montreal and...
Stayed there
for a week for peace. And they were interviewed and for peace in Vietnam.
Well, those are some good interviews. They still float around. You see them on television once.
And there's a Beatles song about it. I can't remember. What's the name of it?
Oh, that's terrible, Peter, that I don't know.
I don't know either. Well.
But someone.
Hey, we're active rockers, man. It's, the Beatles.
Someone will write to us.
Yeah. Let's see. So this is actually somebody wanted me to interview somebody about this, but they said, Dear Peter, it's hard to believe that it has been 40 years since John Lennon and Yoko Ono recorded their anthem of the American anti-war movement, Give Peace a Chance. Oh, I mean, I was going to bring that. I forgot to do that. In a Montreal hotel. Not so hard to believe is that it's still a relevant plea today as it was in 1969. There are approximately 38 active conflicts and or wars in the world today. It's terrible. Still
happening. Awful.
And in that very same hotel, who was holding forth yesterday?
Ooh, was it Bush?
George W. Bush came to Montreal to give a speech, and it was marred by a fiery protest that resulted in 5 arrests. He received about $100,000 to speak on Thursday to about 1,000 people who each paid $400 for the steak luncheon. At the same hotel where Beatle John Lennon and Yoko Ono staged their 1969 Bet In for Peace.
Well, John Lennon would be highly disappointed.
Yeah. Outside, some 300 protesters burned an effigy of Bush and riot police on horseback. That doesn't make sense. They mean on horseback.
On horseback. Yeah.
Made 5RS for mischief.
Mischief.
Does that go on your record? You ever arrested? Yeah. So what for? Mischief. But also disturbing the peace and interfering with police work. Inside the Queen Elizabeth Hotel, Bush told his audience he was aware some things could have been handled better during his eight-year presidency.
Yeah. Some things.
Yeah.
Where do we start?
Yeah, well, he said, I am confident that I made decisions. I'm not going to try to imitate him. Based on principle that I made calls as best I could. I believe that. I do believe he made calls as best he could.
Because his best is pretty weak.
Yeah, yeah. And he says, I did not sell my soul. He left out a little phrase there. Right?
What, to the devil?
Well, he doesn't say that. But remember, Hugo Chavez said that he could smell sulfur at the United Nations after Bush spoke. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So there you go. But I was thinking about this. I was thinking about the right and the left and how much airtime and TV time and all this media coverage that these right-wing freaks get. And I thought, you know, I'm part of the show. I'm part of the freak show. And, well, if you don't mind me saying so, we both are. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they are.
Yeah, I heard you somewhat that you described me as a little bit subversive.
You?
Yeah.
As a little bit subversive. That's an insult where I come from. You got to be a lot subversive.
Okay,
you want to subvert the dominant paradigm.
Yeah.
Well, that's a big word. Paradigm. Deep. Model or a reigning operational madness. Okay, we want to subvert that. So, so it's good to be subversive.
Oh, yeah.
But you got me off track.
Oh, no.
What was I talking about? Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, part of this freak show. Takes two to tango. And I was thinking, I don't even want to name some of the institutions involved. But Barack Obama and his spokespeople are involved in some argument with this stupid television network. And I was thinking, man, these guys must be going crazy. I mean, they're getting such free publicity.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're responding. They shouldn't even respond.
Yeah. So I think, you know, that we've made a lot of fun of, let me put it another way. We, I think, had a pretty serious Let me put it another way. We have extraordinarily serious criticisms of the whole last 8 years before Barack Obama. And this illegal regime of George W. Bush and Darth Vader, Dick Cheney, who continues like the voice from the crypt. He keeps on keeping on with all this stuff.
He really does.
And Sarah Palin and Joe the Plumber and all these people. And
Joe the Plumber's kind of faded a little bit.
Well, they all have. Yeah. Yeah. But the point being is that they don't do anything for solving problems, and they're easy targets because they are such whack jobs, and they say the oddest things, and they stir up lots of people. That's what's really unfortunate. And they create a lot of paranoia about what the Bush administration's doing, our rights, our liberties, our constitutional guarantees. And, you know, you can understand this, that, you know, that average people with that have sort of a predilection towards this kind of politics, towards right-wing politics, can get very upset. I mean, we are in a, you know, the way forward is not clear. The Obama administration hasn't all of a sudden, you know, become this icebreaker that we're, right. You know, everything is being fixed or anything, you know, short of that. I mean, it took the Bush administration like 8 years to tie these knots. So yeah. The idea that you could untie it in a few months isn't very realistic. And, I mean, historically, Barack Obama fits into the mold of a typical American president. I mean, there are a couple of atypical presidents, one being George Bush and the other Ronald Reagan, who essentially wrecked everything, who spit on the Constitution. But there's a real continuity between Obama, Clinton, you know, people hate me for saying this, George Bush Sr.,
it's true.
Yeah, you know, Carter, Ford, even Nixon. I mean, if you think about Nixon, I mean, a crook, a liar, what a weird president that is. But he passed all these things like the Clean Water Act and the EPA and stuff like that. And then you're going back, you know, even further. You know, the grand period in the last century, in many ways, was really Dwight Eisenhower, a moderate to liberal Republican. There was a few bad things going on, like segregation. You know, I don't want to forget that. But it was a period of relative prosperity and calm. Not good for everybody. It never is. But so the point being is Obama is not left the terrain of you know, our basic American presidency. And the idea that elites run things, that the political apparatus is subservient to the to corporate domination, well, that's nothing new. I mean, that was happening in the 1830s.
Yeah,
1830, I didn't say 1930s, 1830s. In the 1860s, in the 1880s, in the 1890s, some of the big struggles were trying to bring some of these, the most rapacious corporations under control. And there were, you know, there's been a lot of gains, no doubt about it. I mean, usually through social movements demanding it, then they were codified into laws. Because left of the tender mercies of the government and the corporations, we'd still just have, you know, white propertied men running the show, being eligible for voting, and nothing would have changed. So fortunately, that's all changed. So, but now we find ourselves at a pretty desperate point in American history. We just came out of one of the worst presidencies in the history of the United States. I mean, incompetence joined with the far right wing politics and arrogance beyond belief, and probably, I mean, just for the sake of trying to be a little objective, and probably having stolen two elections. So, this is, Democrats are better than a stick in the eye, but they're not much better. I mean, Bush was a major stick in the eye to all of us, and the results are what we're looking at today. Well, that gets back to the third of the people that identify with all this right-wing nonsense, but you can understand where their paranoia comes from. I mean, things are really screwed up.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But they thought everything was just hunky-dory during the Bush years, and so flipped to a Barack Obama. They just don't even think about who created all of it, because that's their guy.
Well, they are being played, because, I was looking this up, and I can't remember how many families it is. I thought it was the five families, but it's really the five families are the mafia. But there's these rich white wing, sound like Bugs Bunny.
White
witch wing, I can say it. Rich right-wing families like the Scaifes, the Mellons, the Coors, people like this, that contribute billions of dollars all the time to fund these right-wing organizations and institutions and think tanks and all of that, that play upon people's worst fears. So rather than attempting to calm them, because essentially what they want to do, they're manipulating these people to be the base, the popular base of their interest, that of the super-rich corporate owners.
Yeah.
And as I've said any number of times, there's not a lot of them. I mean, we're talking about at best 1% of the population, and you can't do things like run or win elections or run a government with 1% of people.
So you have to fool.
Yeah, so you got to get enough. All these people all upset, about where is the Obama born and the fascist, fascist commie taking away our rights and
socialists.
Yeah, all this. So this gets people all upset. So, although I went back into what I said I was going to try to get away from, I would like to try to find some common ground in many ways, to look at the problems we have, and rather than looking at the worst of everything, I mean, how can we recreate? I mean, here's what we really have to do. We have to create those movements that altered American history in the past. I don't mean the same ones, but rather ones that meet the needs or what we identify the problems and then fix the problems. Now, I probably am going to get nowhere with a lot of you. Let me put it another way. I've said that quite a few times tonight, haven't I? Already. Hey, if you want to call in on any of this, please do. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan are at the mics on Night Call at 313-298-WRIF, and we welcome your views as well. So here is Michael Moore's action plan, 15 things every American can do right now. Now, Michael Moore, and I started to say many of you. I'd say a few of you have negative opinions about Michael Moore. I'm not quite sure why, but whatever.
I just don't agree with what he says.
There you go. Five things we must demand the President and Congress do immediately. And I can imagine a small number of people disagreeing with this. Declare a moratorium on all home evictions. Not one more family should be thrown out of their home. The banks must adjust their monthly mortgage payments to be in line with people, for what people's homes are now truly worth and what they can afford. It also must be stated by law, if you lose your job, you cannot be tossed out of your home. Now, this has
some merits.
Precedent. Besides merit.
Oh.
Yeah. Congress must join the civilized world and expand Medicare for all Americans, which would mean a single nonprofit source must run a universal health care system that covers everyone. Medical bills are now the number one cause of bankruptcies and evictions in the country. Medicare for All will end this misery, and this is already a bill that's happening. But, you know, what essentially, if you read Dennis Kucinich, for instance, the congressman from Cleveland, let me see if I can get this up real quickly. What's going through Congress now may have some, here it is.
Are you sure? Where is it?
I wrote some guy.
Oh yeah, he's mad at you.
Yeah, and I
question his values, Peter.
Yeah, and
how
I
dare
said,
you?
Yeah, I said, what kind of values do you have? Values? How dare you question my values?
He's not happy.
Yeah, all right. I don't know. I'll have to read this some other time. Let's go back to Michael Moore. Demand publicly funded elections and a prohibition on elected officials leaving office and becoming lobbyists. And so tell me whether you agree or disagree with any of this. Do you have that that thing from Michael Bloomberg in New York City?
Oh, yes, I do. Right here. How he set a record.
Yeah.
Here you go.
Yeah. I don't know where mine is. All right. So right now, it's, you know, we're run by the golden rule. He who has the gold rules. Michael R. Bloomberg, the Wall Street mogul whose fortune catapulted him into New York City Hall, has set another staggering financial record. He has now spent more of his own money than any other individual in United States history in the pursuit of public office. Newly released campaign records show the mayor, as of Friday, had spent, you ready for this? He's running for mayor. There was term limits on this guy. Right? He couldn't run more than two terms. Well, he figured out and got it passed that he could run for a third term.
Oh, I didn't even realize
that.
Yeah.
So now he has spent, so far, $85 million on his latest reelection campaign and is on pace to spend between $110 million and $140 million before the election on November 3rd.
Now, totally, he spent like $250 million.
Yeah. A quarter of a billion dollars.
Yeah, trying to get elected and succeeding.
Yeah. New Jersey's John S. Corzine, who's a Democrat, has plunked down a total of $130 million in two races for governor and one for United States Senate. Steve Forbes poured $114 million into his two bids for president. And, a lot of these rich people just want to, they want to buy their way into it.
Power.
He's got 100 employees, the Bloomberg campaign does. His campaign now has a staff larger than 97% of all businesses in New York City. And his political operation has become a one-man economic stimulus program. For instance, buying $9,000 worth of pizza from Goodfellas Brick Oven Pizza on Staten Island and in the Bronx. The company had suffered a big drop in business since the start of the recession. He's spent $48 million on TV ads. In the meantime, the guy he's running against has $6 million.
Poor guy.
Yeah. So
good luck with that.
The Bloomberg campaign has spent $322,521 on food, $40,000 on parking.
My gosh.
So
that's insanity.
Who disagrees with Michael Moore's, these are five things we should demand of the president and Congress immediately. Demand publicly funded elections. And, you know, I'm not saying that we should give these guys billions, but they could have, like, you know, they could have websites and then a month ahead of time start running and they would have forums that,
Please don't do this 3-year stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Or four, really.
I don't even want to get into this one, but I'll read it to you. Each of the 50 states must create a state-owned public bank like they have in North Dakota. Number five, why is that in there of all the things? Save this fragile planet and declare that all energy resources above and beneath the ground are owned collectively.
Ooh, my God.
Now it comes out. This guy's a commie.
I love him.
Yeah. If you haven't seen Capitalism, A Love Story, his latest documentary, check it out.
I just saw Sicko this week for the first time.
Yeah.
I haven't been able to make myself watch it, and I can see why. 3 hours of hell.
Yeah, and he's got 10 other things. 5 things we can do to make Congress and the president listen to us, which is just things
Call
that
them.
People are doing. 5 things we should do to protect ourselves and our loved ones until we get through this mess. This is kind of weird. I mean, it's like personal stuff. Take care of yourself and your family. Sorry to go all Oprah on you, Michael Moore says. But she's right. Find a place of peace in your life and make the choice to be around people who are not full of negativity and cynicism.
I think that means a lot. It really does.
Isn't that us?
No!
Aren't we full of negativity and
no,
cynicism? We
we're
are.
Full of...
We're totally negative about most things.
That's
I want to hear
know
this.
What's real.
Yeah.
We know what reality is.
But that doesn't mean we're not negative
sucks.
And cynical.
Okay, about things that deserve the negativity
right.
and cynicism.
All right. So don't hang out with us. I don't care.
I'm not gonna have a great time.
Yes.
We don't need you.
Speaking of documentaries, last night on HBO, I watched Outrage, which was the 2009 Academy Award documentary winner. And it's about closeted gays in public life. And they said on there that Congress is probably the institution with the most closeted gays of any institution
really?
In America.
Oh, my.
Most of them are Republicans. And, I mean, the staffers are, and, you know, guys running, particularly men. But, you know, it was funny. They had a lot of interviews with Mary Cheney, the Darth
Dick's
Vader's daughter.
Who's a lesbian.
In a committed relationship
yeah.
with a woman. And
they have a couple kids.
And, you know, it's so bizarre. You know, Coors.
She used to work for them.
And she, but Coors funds all these right-wing homophobic organizations and what have you,
yeah.
you know, anti gay marriage.
Yeah.
And Mary Cheney worked for them doing campaigns to attract
gay people,
gay beer drinkers.
Right.
Yeah. Coors, though. We used to call that Colorado Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
Right? What's Coors Light? Water.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. But it was really weird.
One of the things, check that out.
At BuzzFlash.com, there's a little video by, what's the man's name? I can't remember. But he's written this book called Max Blumenthal, I think it is. He wrote a book called Republican Gomorrah. Just kind of exposes, I mean, it's just like... I just can't believe it. But they did this study.
I can.
They did this study. They took like 100 men.
Yeah.
And they measured their attitudes on gays. And they took the 50 most homophobic anti-gay men
uh-huh.
and separated them into one group. And they took all the men who either were neutral or who didn't care one way or
right.
the other. I guess that's the same
thing. A little
more
open-minded or whatever.
Right? Yeah, tolerant. And they separated into groups. And then they showed both groups gay porn.
Uh-huh, sure.
And they had these ways, which since it's a family show, I'm not gonna really say how they did it. But they measured the arousal level of each group. Guess which group had the greatest arousal factor to the gay porn?
Oh, this is a no-brainer.
Yeah, the homophobic men.
Yes.
Yeah.
But obviously it wasn't woman on woman because they would all like that.
Yeah, they're all of them. All of them. Right.
Bring it.
Bring it on. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, there's lots of... here's an old friend, actually.
Phone calls?
Phone calls, yeah. I had a few more things. But what do you think? Let me just go back to the screen 1 second here. So, Michael Moore, hero to some, devil to others.
Oh, absolutely. Ooh,
who disagrees on declare a moratorium on all home evictions? Not one more family should be thrown out of their home. And if you say, I don't care if they can't pay their bills, that's too bad.
Right.
Well, I got to tell you, pal, if you think like that, that affects
the bottom line.
The value of your home as well. Congress must join the civilized world and expand Medicare for all Americans. A lot of people disagree with that. Demand publicly funded elections. How many prohibition on elected officials leaving office and becoming lobbyists? I hope most of you would agree with that one. That'd probably save this fragile planet and declare that all energy resources above and beneath the ground are owned collectively by all of us. That's going to get a lot of opposition as well, but so be it. Peter Werby and Jillian Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. And let's go to an old friend that we remember, Jillian and I remember, from our IE America days when we did a full-time syndicated talk show way back in 2000. It's Chris from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Chris, how you doing? You're on the air.
I'm doing really well, guys. How are you?
Hey, Chris.
Hi, sweetie. You know, one thing that I find interesting, talking about Michael Moore, and the left in general, and the Democratic Party in particular, and I am a proud liberal American, is the second that we get in power, we on the left, you, me, Jillian, if you go to any liberal website or read a liberal newspaper, we immediately start bitching and moaning and whining and yelling, we have to do this now. This has to happen. Can you imagine? I mean, it's like we completely forgot about the past 8 years with Bush and Cheney. It was like an eight-year stretch where I felt like I had a booger on my finger. And as soon as we get in power, every liberal that I can think of starts yelling, well, this isn't happening fast enough, and Barack Obama is selling us out, and we want this, and we want that. I mean, can you imagine if the right wing had done this to George W. Bush? We would have loved it.
Wait a minute, Chris. They got everything they want almost immediately, and I'm one of the people that said, I don't even know if they use the term sell out, but I never expected much more from Barack Obama than we've gotten. If you think more is coming, well, you are not one of the people expressing negativity and cynicism that...
No, the point is that Barack Obama always ran as a centrist, and
sure.
I can't see one thing that he is promising or that he is delivering that he didn't talk about during the campaign. He never talked during the campaign about single payer. But if you talk about health care, immediately the liberals start, the public option isn't good enough. We have to have single payer right away.
Well, what's wrong with Chris? What's wrong with that? What's wrong placing demands on the political structure?
Nothing is wrong with it. I just think that we kind of get ahead of ourselves. And as I said, if the right wing had done this, it would have been wonderful for our side. And I think if the second we get in power and we start forgetting what we went through in the past 8 years, we start making coin for the right wing, because all we're doing is battling amongst ourselves as to what we want now, and not working for what we can reasonably get. Every bill.
Well, wait, before you go on, let me say this, that I think support is eroding for Barack Obama, certainly not from the right wingers who never had any support from him to begin with, but I think that people expect a dramatic change, not finding that, although, I mean, it's so pleasant to have that man there rather than that bumbling fool that stole two elections in a row, that in itself was worth the effort. But I think what's going to happen is that a lot of people who are really energized by the Barack Obama campaign and related to the slogan of change rather than the substance of what he was promising, which wasn't too grandiose, I agree, that it's very possible that the Republicans could make great gains in 2010.
Well, why are we adding to that? I mean, or why would we? Or why should we add to that? Why can't we just work for...
Well, I mean, some of this stuff, like his health plan, sucks, to be quite blunt. I mean, if you read, like, Dennis Kucinich, I mean, he's talking, this is going to be a boon for the insurance companies. All of a sudden, they're going to get 45 million more customers. I don't know why, with a public option or anything, they're not just all on board for this, saying, yeah, sure, great, yeah, I don't care what, as long as you get as long as you get this health care bill in there, we're fine with it. Yeah, you don't want none of those pre-existing condition things. We can't cut anybody. Yeah, great. We're going to make billions and billions of more. I think we got to retire them all. Well, listen, Chris, I actually got to do some commercials, but I hear you, and I think that's part of the discussion. And I thank you, and it's good hearing from you after so many years. Are you with me still?
I'm right here.
Oh, yeah. How's everything in Santa Fe? We used to love the broadcast on our Santa Fe affiliate out there. What a great place.
Love it there.
I miss the IU Radio America days. I really do.
I know.
Chris from Santa Fe, thanks for joining us on Night Call. All right, we're going to take a break and get all of you on the air. A couple open lines, 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
Now, a message from one of the co-founders of ADAM, the American Divorce Association for Men.
Gentlemen, going through a divorce is tough, but it's even more difficult when your rights are not being protected. As a lawyer, I get asked a lot of questions about divorce, but I have some questions for you. Do you know why it may not be a good idea to move out of the house, or that it may matter who files first, or how child custody, support, and property division are decided? Call us at 248-356-ADAM and let us answer all of your questions. We specialize in representing men in divorce. We can explain the law to you, how it applies to your situation, and what should be done to protect you. Together, we can design strategies that will achieve your short and long-term goals. Believe me, there is a light at the end of the tunnel of divorce, and with proper planning, that light doesn't have to be an oncoming train. Be smart, understand the law and what your rights are before you take action. Call 248-356-ADAM. That's 248-356-ADAM.
It's the East Side's newest hotspot, Santino's.
Hey, it's Meltdown. Every Monday, join me and Riff Rock Girl Sarah for the biggest pigskin payoff party in the Motor City. There'll be draft beer specials, prize giveaways, and one lucky person could win a cool $5,000 if the opening kick is returned for a touchdown.
Plus, tomorrow is Ladies' Night. Check out Santino's Martini Lounge nightclub and sip on $5 martinis.
Santino's has nightly specials like hospitality industry nights Tuesdays. Enjoy 25% off your entire tab from 9 to midnight. Wednesday, work at a spa or salon, get half off drinks.
Thursdays, Mike Scrag spins live from 9 till 1. And to get you home, there's free local shuttle service.
Friday, October 30th, pay no cover charge at Santino's first annual Halloween party. Dress up and you might win cool cash prizes in the costume contest.
Santino's on Van Dyke and Washington Township. Check out their weekly specials at santinosbar.com.
If you're like most Michigan families, it's a tough time to face paying for college. At Oakland University, we understand what you're going through. That's why OU makes an exceptional education available at a truly affordable price, with more than half of all OU students receiving help through financial aid. Learn more at our transfer open house on Tuesday, October 27th, from 4:30 to 7 p.m. on the campus of Oakland University. At the transfer open house, you'll receive an immediate response to your admissions application. Our academic advisors will answer questions about your educational plan, and you can even schedule an orientation session all in one evening. When you transfer to OU, you'll find a wide variety of majors, state-of-the-art facilities, and the personal attention of a small campus with professors who know you by name. Attend the Transfer Open House Tuesday, October 27th, and see how an exceptional college education is within reach. For more information...
Hey, all you college football fans, would you like to win an ultimate sports den to watch your favorite games? If you think you know your X's and O's, click on the Taco Bell logo on your streaming player right now to try your luck at a game of tic-tac-toe for a chance to win a $20,000 ultimate sports den sponsored by Taco Bell. Plus, you'll find out instantly if you've won $20,000 toward the ultimate sports den you deserve. And five lucky people will be chosen at random to win $100 Taco Bell Bucks gift certificates. Click on the Taco Bell logo on your streaming player right now. Brought to you by Taco Bell.
1-866-290-8282.
This is my way to learn Spanish.
This is my way to learn French.
My way to learn Russian.
Italian.
Japanese.
My way.
My way.
Chinese.
My way to learn a foreign language.
The best way to learn a foreign language is your way. Rosetta Stone invites you to try absolutely free a software program developed around the way you think and the way you learn. The same way you learned your first language. In fact, it's been recognized as the fastest, easiest way to learn a language, guaranteed.
It's totally my way to learn Spanish.
No classrooms, no boring drills, no useless memorization. It's a learning program that works around you, not the other way around. And right now, you can try it absolutely, positively free with a free demo CD-ROM.
Free. That's definitely my way.
Try Rosetta Stone for free by calling 1-800-441-3955. 1-800-441-3955. For your free demo, call 1-800-441-3955.
Now's the time.
Now's the time to make a difference.
Now's the time to do what's right.
To help a family.
Now's the time to volunteer.
To make a commitment.
To make new friends.
To make dreams come true.
To help a child.
Now's the time to help Habitat for Humanity build hope and change lives with a family in your community or around the world.
Now's the time.
Now, more than ever, help build it.
Visit Habitat.org.
There's something happening across America. People aren't just calling themselves DirecTV customers. They're calling themselves fans. That's because DirecTV has exclusive sports packages like NFL Sunday Ticket and free NASCAR Hot Pass. DirecTV has the most HD channels with over 130, soon to be over 200, and 50 times more movies available in 1080p. Perhaps that's why DirecTV is ranked number one in customer satisfaction among all TV service providers. So don't just watch TV. Become a huge fan. Switch to DirecTV today. Call 1-888-359-5566. There's no equipment to buy and no startup costs. Packages start at just $29.99 a month. Call 1-888-359-5566. That's 1-888-359-5566. Sports subscriptions sold separately. New customers only on approved credit. Credit card required except Massachusetts and Pennsylvania. Hardware lease and programming commitment required and available separately. Other conditions apply. Call for details.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and joined by Jalene Jordan. We're at 313-298-WRIF. I guess nobody's excited one way or the other about Michael Moore's action plan. 15 things every American can do right now. It's at his site, michaelmoore.com, or you can go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com as well. And the first thing he says is declare a moratorium on all home evictions. Not one more family should be thrown out of their homes. The banks must adjust their monthly mortgage payments to be in line with what people's homes are now truly worth. That's one thing. A number of things. Demand publicly funded elections and a prohibition on elected officials leaving office and becoming lobbyists. They'd say our free speech is being trampled on. Did you see this, Jalene? This is amazing. Mm-hmm. About all these musicians who are understandably upset that their music used to torture people at Guantanamo.
Yes.
How do you torture people? I mean, I've been at musical performance that I thought was torture, but this is...
Right.
But here, a coalition of mega bands and singers outraged that music, including theirs, was cranked up to help break uncooperative detainees at Guantanamo Bay is joining retired military officers and liberal activists to rally support for President Barack Obama's push to shutter the Navy-run prison for terrorist suspects in Cuba. And they're suspects. And, this stuff was never even proved against these guys. Some of them obviously were. There's still hundreds of people that went through that torture chamber that Bush was running that there was never any concrete evidence that they did anything. Pearl Jam, REM, and Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails are among the musicians who have joined the national campaign to close Guantanamo. On behalf of the campaign, the National Security Archive in Washington is filing a Freedom of Information Act request seeking classified records that detail the use of loud music as an interrogation device. Thomas Blanton, who's the director of the archive, said, at Guantanamo, the U.S. government turned a jukebox into an instrument of torture. Based on documents that have already been made public and interviews with former detainees, the archive says the playlist featured cuts from AC/DC, Britney Spears, the Bee Gees, Marilyn Manson, and other groups. The Meow Mix cat food jingle, the Barney theme song, and an assortment of Sesame Street tunes also were pumped into detainee cells. You're going, oh, man, that's certainly not heavy torture. Can you imagine, though, you've just been sold by an Afghan bounty hunter to American soldiers. You're transported out of your homeland. I don't have any sympathy for people that have committed criminal acts of any kind, let alone murder or attempted murder, or conspiracy to murder. But it's not even clear what percentage of the people that wound up in the CIA and Guantanamo-like torture chambers actually did what they were accused of. We don't know, because one of the ways we know is they have something called a judicial process. Mm-hmm. But then we just turned it over to a lot of sadists who probably thought, this is great fun, because you get to have ultimate power over somebody. Let's see if they'll break. Let's just pump all this AC/DC. Dirty deeds done dirt cheap. You know.
They could use me. For oh, boy.
Yeah. Let me see. And they're talking about one case, a citizen of Mauritania who had been at Guantanamo for more than 7 years. They used it to stress him because he believed music is forbidden. They repeatedly played a song called Let the Bodies Hit the Floor by the band Drowning Pool. And let me see. Do they name all the bands here? Tom Morello of Rage Against the Machine, Jackson Brown, Rise Against, Roseanne Cash, Billy Bragg, who the English folk rock singer, and The Roots, all of whom are part of the broader national campaign to close Guantanamo. So, I mean, there's been extraordinary improvements under the Obama administration. So rather than trying to keep this open and okaying torture that not only disgraced the United States throughout the world, did very, very little to get any information of any importance, trashed.
Can you imagine how mad those prisoners are?
And then pissed off people. Yeah. So probably rather than protecting us, we have just recruited how many more people to be enemies of the United States. And if anything comes to fruition and you see these people are arrested in these alleged terror plots, they're not going after Bush or Cheney or Rumsfeld. They're going after you and me.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to ride on a train or a plane or something like that. And because that from day one, being September 11th, 2001, the Bush administration and everybody there involved screwed up everything, beginning with allowing 9/11 to occur. All right, 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Here is Dennis. Dennis is in Whitmore Lake. Dennis, hi. It's Peter and Jolene on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, how are you doing? This is our second time calling us.
Welcome.
I wanted to call about the health care system. I'm really looking forward to this thing passing, but I'm seeing a lot of flack come from the opposition, mostly right-wing, and a lot of lies and slander about what the bill is really about.
Mm-hmm.
I work for a large company, and I'm sort of at the bottom of the food chain, and even though the ground force, I do believe, carries the company, we do not get very good health coverage. And
let me tell you this. It's going to be worse. It's going to be worse for me. It's going to be worse for you. It's going to be worse for everyone with a health care plan, because the costs are being purposely driven up by the insurance companies. Small businesses are expecting huge raises in what they're going to have to pay, which means they're either going to lessen the coverage or they are going to take more out of our pay.
Well, and I understand that, and I follow that quite a bit. And I have to give it up a little bit to the right wing, because they're grassroots campaigning against this health care bill, mostly funded by the health care companies and pharmaceuticals, has been quite amazing. I mean, even if, the spreading of lies and stuff like that in the death panels has gone really far to where a lot of people actually do believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish... I vote Democrat. I am a very strongly liberal Democrat, and I would really wish that wish the Democrats would sort of get together and say, put up some ads and say, like, hey, we're putting together this bill, and show it in states where Republicans are running in office and say, all you got to do is air it a few times and say, hey, look, this senator here, if you don't have health care right now, he doesn't want you to have it. So how do you feel about that? And then voice that in your next election. Because we're trying to provide this for you, and he's trying to prohibit you from getting that.
Yeah, well, I think a lot could be done around that, except that there has to be a health care bill that is stronger than this. It has to convince people of a number of things, even, you know, whereas I almost all of us think that there has to be health care reform. But we want to be assured that the quality of our care, first off, I want to be assured that it covers everybody, and this bill doesn't, and it doesn't cover everybody right away. They launched Medicare, I forgot, in like a matter of months. Now they're talking about this has got to take years click in. And you got to remember, which I'm sure you do, that Medicare essentially is the socialized medicine that these right-wingers are going crazy about when they want to extend it to people under 65. I mean, why is there socialized medicine? Why is it okay for that for people over 65, but it's not okay for those of us under 65? You know, by the way, too, I'm looking at this thing. It says from Dennis Kucinich, and I referenced this a little while ago, and I'm looking through this I got to make sure this is actually from him, because it's got a few things that's making me a little suspicious, although it may be for him. All right. Thank you very much, Dennis. One of the things, going back to what Chris from New Mexico said, one of the things we want, we got to fight for what we want. And if those of us that want a single-payer universal health care system, Medicare for all, and everybody in, nobody out, get rid of all the private for-profit companies, and they can, you know, the ones that have the expertise can be slotted into running this system, but the huge administrative costs, the enormous people that are, the more enormous number of people that are left out, the whole idea of what comes about when you have a for-profit medical system rather than a system that's based around trying to keep people well from the beginning, you know, they almost have vested interest in people getting sick. Think about it. Because if we were all, if we were all very, very well, they wouldn't make any money. So this is going to destroy our economy. I think Obama is right in this. We're going to be paying more and more. So if a health care bill doesn't come along that's going to guarantee, the other thing I wanted to say, which I forgot before, was that we don't get a rise in costs. In other words, we shouldn't have to pay more. We should either pay the same or we should pay less. And the quality of service has to remain the same. We have to be assured of that. All right, Dennis, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Some open lines for you at 313-298-WRIF. Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan. Here is Paul in Sterling Heights. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jalene.
Hi.
I am really angry right now.
What about?
I'm a Ford worker. I have the time to talk to you. I work midnights. I have the time now because the first part of Sunday is usually sort of slow for me before they bring in the day shift 4 hours early. I'm an electrician.
Okay.
And I had my say at the union about this next round of concessions. The union thinks would be best for us to vote yes on. And basically, you know, I realize the atmosphere that we're being asked to do this in is one of something called free trade, which we both know is not fair trade. It's not fair trade. It's about making the unions in the United States go away. It's about us being competitive, but competitive with what? The average auto worker in China makes $12 a day. Do I have to compete against that?
Yep, you do. That's what's happening. That's what they're doing to us.
So I come into work, and I see this piece of paper in our break rooms. Honest to God, this is exactly what it says, Peter. Vote no. Send my job to Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And I've been putting this on. Is this our union or Fox News? Fear tactics, really? Quote, find out just what any people will quietly submit to, and you have the exact measure of the injustice and wrong which will be imposed on them. Unquote, Frederick Douglass. I am incensed, Peter.
Well, I don't blame you because our former employer, Ron Gettelfinger, and many other union so-called leaders are submitting to is this capitalist blackmail. They're saying essentially that. Either you start reducing wages, reducing health benefits, reducing your pensions, except two-tier wages, all the rest of the concessions that are made over and over and over again. And once these corporations smell the blood, they're not going to stop. Rather than fighting against concessions, they agree to them. I mean, when they try to do this to unions in France, you know what they do? They have a general strike. They have the whole damn country stops. You're not doing this to us.
They really do stop. They shut it down.
You're not eroding our standard of living. You're not attacking us because of your stupid mistakes. Listen, I don't blame you for being absolutely outraged. Where is he? Where is he on this? Did I hang up on him by mistake?
I don't know. Maybe
he's gone.
I don't know. Maybe he hung up to listen to your response.
Yeah. All right. But if I hung up on you, it was an error. Here's Sean in Monroe. Sean, hi. Welcome. The home of, is it going to be Fermi 3 now, from what I hear?
Yeah, hopefully. And then everybody can be walking around glowing. But I just wanted to say, you know, I'm all about every American should have health care. But I think they're going about it wrong. And let me get your opinion on this. All right.
Go ahead. I believe
because the insurance companies, they pay so much in with lobbyists and campaign contributions and stuff like that. I believe that's the reason why that there's not going to be a health care reform. That's why there's going to be a health care takeover. They don't want to reform it because if they start stepping on the toes of the insurance companies and the big corporations making all this money, if the government starts telling them, hey, you guys can't make this much money off these people, because they just don't have it, then these big corporations and these big insurance and the big pharmaceuticals and all that, they're going to pull their campaign contributions.
Well, I was surprised. I was kind of alluding to that earlier. Certainly, they're all about money. I mean, you and I are all about health. We think our doctors are all about health, and good numbers of them are. I mean, it's the commitment that many healers have is very strong. Obviously, the medical insurance companies, that's not what they're all about at all. And they actually that's why I don't understand any opposition. They stand to make billions and billions of dollars. As I said, if you bring everybody into the system and it's required and you have some sort of, even if you have a public option, they're coming out like the bandits they are.
They're afraid that this is just one step in their demise.
Yeah, well, that could
be opened up further.
And you would think that the auto companies would say, yes, we need a single-payer healthcare system, so we won't have to pay anymore. That's what, I mean, I'm surprised that there are any companies like these Korean and Japanese and German countries that have cited auto plants in the South. They say, well, we don't have any unions to mess with. But in any event, they've got to pay out billions in healthcare costs, where if they put them in Ontario, well, guess what? The government pays for the health care. So I'm surprised I'm surprised that small businessmen who could shed that cost wouldn't be saying, yeah, that's great. But, you know, now I get to that maybe after the break. When we're paying like trillions with a T for wars and expanding the military industrial complex, it doesn't leave a lot of money. Maybe they realize that. All right, Sean, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. Here is Kathleen in Detroit. Hi, Kathleen. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Hey, Kathleen, you with us?
Mm-hmm. There we are.
Yeah, Kathleen. Are you? Sounds like somebody's fucking got a girth. All right. I don't know. Let me see. Yeah, we have time. Roger, can you talk to Kathleen and see what she's up to? 313-298 WRIF. We have open lines for you. Here's Jay in St. Clair. Jay, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm just wondering about the health care issue. I don't think anybody in America is denying that everybody should have health care But, I mean, where I work, I have decent health care.
Mm-hmm.
But underneath the way I'm understanding this reform is that I'm going to either have to pay more out-of-pocket expense, which I'm just barely surviving as it is. And it's just, I don't understand how they can do it. Why couldn't they have, like, these doctors that are graduating from college going to certain hospitals and just dedicate, you know, 4 years of their lives to health care for the poor?
Well, that'd be certainly a terrific idea. In fact, what we need is many, many more doctors, but the American Medical Association keeps clamp on how many positions in medical schools and how many medical schools can open and what have you. But I don't know. I mean, certainly the claim of the proponents of the health care bill say that it won't cost us any money. I mean, I certainly, that's what I said just a little bit ago. I don't want to have to pay more money. So right. That's the two things that we need to be assured of. They have to assure you, Jay, and everyone else that two things. That one, the quality of medical care will either stay the same or hopefully for many people, because many people, you know, they have health care insurance and it sucks. They can't do much with it except for catastrophic illness. And sometimes you say, well, I got cancer. They go, oh, too bad. We're canceling your insurance. We want to get rid of that. But also we want to make sure that it's not an increased cost.
Or for people who can't afford anything at all as it is, that they don't have to start paying for it.
Yeah, yeah. So, no, I think that's a concern, and whether that's been adequately publicly addressed, perhaps the fact that that you have the feeling. I mean, listen, there's very few things in government that ever reduce in cost, right? So, I mean, I think your skepticism is well placed. I don't know what kind of assurance that the government has given, or not the government, but the people that have introduced the bills, the Democrats.
Stand by.
Okay. Yes. All right, Jay, thank you very much. I've got to take a break. And if anybody is on top of that little aspect of it, how do you answer Jay? Jay says, wait a minute, man, I'm barely getting through on what I got. I can't afford to pay any more health care premiums. I'm afraid that's what's going to happen. I guess I don't know this little detail. If you can help out on it, please do. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And there's open lines for you. We'll get to you and other folks when we come back.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
Hey, all you college football fans, would you like to win an ultimate sports den to watch your favorite games? If you think you know your X's and O's, click on the Taco Bell logo on your streaming player right now to try your luck at a game of tic-tac-toe for a chance to win a $20,000 ultimate sports den sponsored by Taco Bell. Plus, you'll find out instantly if you've won $20,000 toward the ultimate sports den you deserve. And five lucky people will be chosen at random to win $100 Taco Bell Bucks gift certificates. Click on the Taco Bell logo on your streaming player right now. Brought to you by Taco Bell.
877-560-8877. Not available in all states. That's Debt Settlement USA. 1-877-560-8877. 1-877-560-8877.
Prices assume 5% down payment at 7.5% APR over 30 years.
Wow, look at this place. 4 bedrooms, 2 baths.
Yeah, I know.
Geez, you're not even 30. We have the same salary, Maggie. How can you afford all this?
My mortgage payment is less than $300 a month.
What? That's less than I pay for rent. How did you...
All I did was call BNI for a list of homes that are being sold for back taxes or foreclosure.
Home foreclosures are on the rise. That means there are great deals out there, especially for first-time home buyers. Like this listing, a 4-bedroom, 2-bath going for under $20,000. That's just $199 a month. Listings go fast, so call BNI for a list of these homes today. Call 1-800-890-4711.
I could actually afford to own my own home.
Yeah, and it's easy. Just call BNI for the list.
Properties that have been foreclosed or repossessed are a real bargain and sometimes sell for little money down. For a list of homes in your area, call 1-800-890-4711. 1-800-890-4711. That's 1-800-890-4711.
These days, carrying a mortgage can overwhelm even the strongest person.
Don't I know that?
But there is a way to help ease your struggle, especially if you're facing foreclosure. One option may be advice from a certified foreclosure prevention specialist. It's absolutely free. Don't struggle. Learn more at www.makinghomeaffordable.gov. That's makinghomeaffordable.gov. because foreclosure is not a foregone conclusion. A message from HUD in partnership with the National Fair Housing Alliance.
Did you know that tap water in your home may be hazardous? Not to your health, but to your appliances and your wallet. Your home's hard water creates pipe clogging line scale, and that can shorten the life of your water heater, ruin your dishwasher, and break down your washing machine. Line scale deposits block the heating element, which cost you up to 25% more. That's an extra $1,200 a year in energy and wear. But you can remove line scale without chemicals, magnets, or salts. It's easy. With HydraCare, the patented device used worldwide. See for yourself at bestsoftwater.com. You simply clip HydraCare to your main water pipe. HydraCare removes and prevents line scale buildup in your entire plumbing system, guaranteed. If your home has hard water, extend the life of your appliances and save money with HydraCare. Just go to bestsoftwater.com. Lower your energy costs. Visit bestsoftwater.com. That's bestsoftwater.com.
Did I win? I won?
Thursday.
Dude, are you serious?
All day this Thursday, exclusively from your walk right in free station, 101.
Who are you?
WRIF. WRIF in WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Peter and Jolene, you're listening to Night Call, the list award winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, if you're ready to testify, 313-298-WRIF. We never got very far with Michael Moore's five things we need to demand the president and Congress do immediately. The first thing was declare a moratorium on all house evictions, home evictions. Not one more family should be thrown out of their home. And I actually received some email. Oh, man, this was so long ago. Let's see. August 24th. Remember we were saying, man, it's so hot out today.
Yeah, right.
Hi, Peter and Jolene. This is from D-Lynn. D-Lynn writes, let me see if I'm right, and this gets to D in Mount Clemens. Did Peter just say he was glad the empty houses in his neighborhood were now sold? I'm sure I did. We had three empty homes on our block, and they all got sold to really great people. Were these foreclosed homes? Well, I know at least one of them was. Maybe all three. I suspect all three were. She says, while I agree home sales always sound good, it makes me sad that the mortgage company that foreclosed in the first place refused to work with the owner at the time and just wrote it off and resold it. Now, I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
I'm facing this myself. My mortgage company refuses to work with me on a modification, so I'll probably be forced to walk away from my home of 9 years. They can write it off and resell it for 30 or 40 grand and someone gets a great house. I couldn't even rebuy it because now my credit is trash. Mm. Didn't Obama say no more for foreclosures? He says, the honeymoon is over for me and Barack. And that's what Chris from Santa Fe was saying, too, is that if we demand from him things that are actually impossible, well, support is going to erode, and here will be the Republicans coming riding back in. I almost would like to, I wish we could just kind of rewind it and say, okay, you're right, Barack Obama is screwing up everything. Let's put in McCain and Palin and give these folks a Republican Congress. Yeah, they'd be in for about 2 months. I mean, if they had, like, the Canadian and European systems where governments could fall, they'd go for, like, a vote of confidence and right. What have you. So... it's terrible.
It is.
Now, I got two conflicting things here. One from Rasmussen reports says 49% of voters nationwide say that passing no health care reform bill this year would be better than passing the plan currently working its way through Congress. Then this is just from, like, Friday. And so I would say, including myself, to be able to pinpoint or to be able to describe in exact terms what this health care bill is going to do, I can't do it. So that erodes confidence in it. On the other hand, a new poll released Tuesday, this was last Tuesday, found most Americans support one of the most controversial health care reform options being debated by lawmakers. The Washington Post ABC News poll found 57% of Americans either strongly or somewhat support having the government create a new health insurance plan to compete with private health insurance plans.
Right.
So that's the so-called public option.
Right, right, right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Hey, Peter, a big fan of the show. I want to say happy birthday, too. It's Murray's birthday.
Hey, Murray.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, that's great.
Big fan of Night Call.
Well, you could sing it. I would.
That's okay.
Yeah. Right.
We don't need to sing tonight on the show.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've been told by my wife, never sing in public. Are you aware of this 2012 deal? I think I was talking about last week about the trailer, this John Cusack film where it's the end of the world.
Oh.
2012 supposedly represents the end of the Mayan time cycle where everything is going to... catastrophically crash. I mean, it's the...
Well, this is a great idea to make this movie and really freak people out.
Well, there's a five-minute trailer. It freaked me out watching the five-minute trailer. I'm wondering what's going to happen for the other hour and 55 minutes.
There's a movie I won't see.
But John Cusack...
I love him.
Hey, John Cusack survives. You know, everybody else...
He should. He's the good guy in every movie, right?
In this one scene where they're escaping from Los Angeles just as it is crashing... into the sea, I don't think they don't mention it, we're probably witnessing 15 million people dying. So, and then all these other scenes, all these, you see the Taj Mahal. I mean, all around the world, everything is collapsing.
Yes.
Anyway, so tonight, John Major Jenkins, who is an expert on the Maya time cycles, 2012 disaster or hype, John Major Jenkins will join us. The myths, fallacies, and truth behind the most intriguing date in history, 2012. And he explains essentially, he's no fun. He explains that the Maya concept of time cycle ending in 2012 and that it offers its true meaning, which essentially that ends, and it's good that this time cycle we're in now ends, but then it's time for rebirth. And the Mayans, they're actually PO'd that, their people are attributing the end of the world to 2012.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So they're good folks. They inhabit Chiapas in Mexico and Guatemala and places there in Mexico, I think. And also, let's see, Susan J. Marks, who has written Aqua Shock, The Water Crisis in America.
Ooh.
And we think, hey, we're here in the Great Lakes. We don't live in Arizona. We don't live in New Mexico. We don't live in Wyoming. We don't even live in Southern California. We live at the land of the Great Lakes, so everything is copacetic here, right?
No. No, no. Yeah. Of course not.
Yeah.
Because we're cynical.
Yeah. So one of the things we're talking about is money, honey, if you want to get along with me. And so where's all our money going? Well, remember, we wanted no permanent bases in Iraq, right? Well,
one
of them was the $736 million new U.S. embassy in Baghdad, the largest of any embassy in the world.
Yes.
It can be seen from the moon, literally. And American diplomats have occupied it for 18 months. It contains multiple significant construction deficiencies. It was built by the first Kuwaiti General Trading and Contracting Company. And this may be chauvinistic, but I don't know. This sort of, I thought, that's who built it? Well, I mean, I wouldn't have been happier if, I would have been happy if it wouldn't have been built.
Right, at all.
Yeah, yeah. Or if it would have spent like $50 million. But this is where our money goes. And they're going to try to recover $130 million from the contractor.
Good luck.
So, you can do a lot with $738 million other than build a new U.S. embassy in Baghdad. They had one.
Yeah, because we're leaving, right?
Yeah, we're leaving,
that's what
right?
I thought. Mm-hmm.
And also, let's see here. Joe Comerford, who is a executive director of the National Priorities Project. And what they figure out is what they could do with all the money that we're spending on these wars. And she says, so you thought the Pentagon was already big enough. Well, what do you know? Especially with the price of the American military slated to grow by at least 25% over the next decade, if the Pentagon's wishes are granted, and they usually are, we're talking about an additional $133 billion added to the Pentagon budget over the next 10 years. This is unnecessary. To give an example, the $915 billion spent so far on Iraq. So now, jeez. George W. Bush, who lied about weapons of mass destruction, he knew there were no weapons of mass. Oh, I mean, he may have believed it, which just shows he's actually abysmally stupid or abysmally evil. Although some people think he's both.
I do.
Right. So look at what's happening in Iraq today. These are the forces that he set in motion that create the kind of chaos and death and destruction that's still going on there. There's only a few American soldiers get killed there every year. I mean, only a few. So it doesn't even make the papers. You probably didn't even think about that any American soldiers were killed there. But there are some Americans that know that. That's the parents. That's the wives and the kids. That's the families. That's the community. Of which an American soldier that was over there, thanks to George W., for no reason other than to be able to establish a $738 million embassy that acts as the headquarters for oil and a military outpost in a part of the world that we should not even be in. So, healthcare? Well, if we hadn't spent almost $1 trillion, then they figure, what was the figures? They were floating figures that with all of what's going to be necessary for veterans' benefits and all that, that George W. Bush's war is going to wind up costing us $2 trillion. And that means, hey, folks, we could buy a lot of health care for that. Well, I'm Peter Werby, and also Jalene Jordan is with me, 313-298-WRIF, and this is going to kill you, Jalene. Here's Lars in Madison Heights. What a story. Lars, you're on the air. Tell us about this.
Oh, I want to discuss the cultural and economic impacts of my new job. I got a position as an extra on the set of the Red Dawn remake.
Oh, right on.
The old Patrick Swayze movie from the early 80s.
Yeah, this one, it's still, even though it's being filmed in Detroit, it's still set in Washington, the state. And then this time China invades with some Russian advisors.
Uh-huh.
And I'm playing one of the Russian an extra Russian advisors. I've been on set all last week and shot like 30 seconds of film that was later reshot with someone else.
So you're not even going to appear in it?
Well, I'm doing more shooting in November.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that's going to wind up in the movie.
Well, yeah, they do shoot a lot that winds up in the cutting floor. Maybe you'll wind up in years to come in the director's cut or something like that. But what do they pay? What's the pay?
For extras, it's $9 an hour plus overtime.
Come on.
12 to 13-hour day.
Come on, $9 in it. So there's not a union or anything, huh?
No, it's what says my voucher, non-union, whatever.
You know, I watched, for some reason or other, I went, of all the places, I went to Cape May, New Jersey, and I started watching all these Patrick Swayze movies. I'm thinking, what am I doing?
you do the strangest things on vacation.
Like Black Dog, about the, you know, this trucking, about these dueling semis and all that. But I was watching Red Dawn, and I'm thinking, man, these guys are doing exactly what they're blowing up the enemy, right? An invader comes into their to our country in the Swayze film, which is the Russians and the Cubans, and they occupy it. And then the resistance forces, us, because what do? We've been throwing bombs at them, blow up their headquarters and stuff like that. Sounds like a lot of what happens when the U.S. Goes to other countries and the folks.
Yeah, really.
It's a little hard to win the hearts and minds. I wonder if if the invaders in these two Red Dawn films are the same deal. They're going to win our hearts and minds. I don't think so. Do you?
Well, and on the set they had Chinese propaganda with posters saying fighting corporate corruption and other things.
Yeah.
If you read the I don't know what you call it, the prelude. At the beginning of the first movie, the original movie, it says something about the worst harvest in years in Russia. So essentially they've committed millions of troops and trillions of dollars because of a bad harvest.
Yeah.
And I haven't read anything, I haven't heard anything about the screenplay of this one, but I'm I've thought about it, the only logical explanation I could think of that China would invade is if we defaulted on the multi-trillion dollars we owe them.
well, wait a minute. You might get a speaking part. You want me to teach you some Russian?
No.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I know. I know one word. Yet.
That's all I know. I think.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. Tavarish.
What's the toast? I used to know the toast.
Tavarish, I think, is comrade.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I know toast in many. Give a toast in many. Languages.
Sure, give me a couple.
Salud, dinero, y amor.
What? You have lots of money and love?
And what's salud? I can't remember what that is.
Salud is health.
Health, yeah, health.
Yeah.
Money and cheers.
Yeah. Cheers.
Drink up.
All right, here's Maurice in Detroit. Maurice, hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Peter. Hi, Julian. How you doing?
Good.
Good.
What's up?
Yeah, I got a question. But all these money these companies got that the government bailed out, would they be safe to invest in? Because they almost like new companies, you know. Ford stock lands with somewhere between $7 and $8 a share. So if they sell cars, the stock should go up.
Well, I know. You know, I know people that bought Ford stock. When wasn't it down to like $1.50 or something like that?
Oh, yeah.
I know somebody bought $5,000 worth of it. And, of course, now Ford made a profit, and they're selling cars pretty handily. So I don't know. If you want to make a killing, Maurice, go for it.
One more thing. You still there, Peter?
I'm here. I'm here and waiting.
You was talking earlier about the torture in the in Guantanamo Bay.
Yeah.
I was wondering if any of our listeners ever tortured anybody.
Whoa.
I have.
You have tortured people?
What'd you do?
For fun or profit?
No, see, somebody stole some of mine, and they wouldn't tell, so I put the music on. We danced for about 3 hours.
You what?
Dance.
I interrogated him.
Oh.
Who did you interrogate?
The guy that stole his something.
The property of mine.
Yeah.
Oh.
Did they give it up?
Well, put it like this. When you start pulling, you put so many knots on a person's head, there ain't no room to put on their head, so you start working on something else.
Well,
Maurice.
This is kind of a neighborhood justice thing, and one could talk about the morality or lack of it and what have you, but that is kind of a personal thing. When you start in codifying it into to government policy, and you have essentially wage workers who are professional torturers, that definitely is off the charts. All right, Maurice, I'll never steal your property, or if I have and you ask me, I'll tell you where it is. All right. Thank you very much. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Ian out in Howell. Ian, hi. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Good.
I'm actually, I've served in the military.
Okay.
In the United States military, and I was calling on the health care. As you stated earlier, my main concern is the quality of the health care.
Yeah.
We've had government health care in the branches, and I've had situations where me or some of my comrades would be turned away. One guy had a venomous snake bite, got turned away. And these guys get turned away, and they're told to come back in, you know, sometimes 2 hours and sometimes 2 to 3 days.
This is VA? This is the VA?
Not even necessarily in the VA, but in active military, on a military base. And speaking of VA, I've been out for about 3 months, and I haven't seen a VA benefit yet.
Hmm.
So, but as far as health care, my main concern was the quality of it, making sure that people are actually getting what they are or are not paying for through their taxes.
Well, I hear you. You know, and it's odd. I mean, we continually hear and get emails from people saying we have the best health care system in the world, and then yet we have all these incredible horror stories of... I mean, listen, once you're in there, I mean, our technology, the medical skills, the medical innovation, the technology is all there. But it's like most medical systems throughout the world and throughout history. The higher you up are up in the pyramid, in the social and economic pyramid, the better care you're going to get. I don't care if you're in the Middle Ages or today. Because, I mean, what do you think the health care quality would be if a general got a snake bite? Don't you think he'd get the care right away?
Exactly. The guys that with gold on their shoulders seem to get in there pretty quick, but, you know, slowly little, you know, apprentices and privates first class don't seem too high a priority to the lieutenant that's administering the health care.
Well, that's the same thing throughout the system. So if you're well paid, if you're middle class or above, your health care is good, and you get they always say, well, you know, anybody can get health care. All you got to do is go to an emergency room, which George Bush said. Well, they found that people without health care, I can't remember, and I hate to quote statistics that are wrong, but a high proportion of people without health care had undiagnosed diabetes and high blood pressure.
Silent killer.
When they have an attack, then they'll go into the emergency room, and, you know, when they're having a stroke or they're having some complication for diabetes. But we've got to get it so we're not having these discussions. I mean, we certainly say that nobody that has fought in wars or in war zone should have to suffer some of the indignities that people have, even at VA hospitals. And I hear mixed stories. Some people tell me good things about their VA treatment. We know what happened at Walter Reed Hospital a few years ago under the Bush administration. So that can't be allowed to happen in the military, but it shouldn't happen to our civilians either. Why should we even have to think about health care? Why should health care even be a debate? I mean, when it's critical to the quality of life as us as human beings on the planet.
You know,
all right,
Peter,
Ian, I got to move on. Thank you.
We haven't talked a lot about the Office of the Attending Physician.
What's that?
All the members of Congress go for their health care.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it is their health care is amazing. They are so lucky. And it's better than anyone else's health. It's better than yours. It's better than anyone who has health insurance.
I just saw something that they were covered under the healthcare system that covers all federal employees. They have a separate and special one?
There's an office right in the...
In other words, they're covered under
congressional headquarters there.
Yeah.
They can just walk down, and if they have any problem, and they can have anything taken care of for free.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, there are leaders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Here's Lawrence in Whitmore Lake. Lawrence, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. You're on WRIF. Thanks for joining us.
How's it going?
Good.
I just wanted to cover one of the things about the healthcare thing that was said earlier about no cost.
Yeah.
Basically, there's everything in government costs something. It's just going to come out of the taxes. You know what I mean?
Sure.
I was watching something earlier in the week where a businessman, an independent business owner,
mm-hmm.
He was a small business owner. He had about 20 employees or whatever, and he was paying about a little over $10,000 a year for his health care for his people. And under the bill, when he was looking through it, he actually saw that there would be like a ninefold increase, which would be $90,000 to keep like what would be the like the private option, I guess you would call it in this case.
You know, Lawrence, I hear so many stuff, so much stuff. I mean, nothing would surprise me about government mishandling stuff. On the other hand, there's been so much mis- and disinformation purposely floated to scare the hell out of people. I mean, one of the things that I know that's supposed to happen is that, and I can't remember what, I'm trying to think how much I pay a year, maybe $2,400 a year or something like that, copay for the health insurance I have, that I would continue to pay that. That would be, now wait a minute, I would keep, my, you know, that's what I mean, I got to go find, I got to find out about it, because wait a minute, under this system, I would still keep my health care, right?
Yeah.
Supposedly. I mean, when they say that they're going to do the competitive bidding for the, you know, to try and compete and make the prices go down, well, it's just like everything else. I mean, if you start making, you know, foreign cars, what happened to our, you know, our local car companies like Ford and GM and everybody else? They all went out of business. So when you make the government, who can basically take our own money and say we're going to make our prices lower but increase taxes, when really you're going to pay the same amount as the other guy, but, you know, in the long, you know, in the short run, it's going to look like you're not paying as much. Well, there's going to be people jumping on the boat all over the place, leaving, you know, the private sectors. So when you have, you know, government control over something like that, you're going to start putting people out of business all over the place with something like that.
Well, I think what's going to happen now, I mean, health care, if nothing happens, health care costs are skyrocketing. They're going to let's say this whole thing falls flat. I mean, they're predicting a 9 to 10% increase in health care costs for small businesses, individual.
Anyway,
right. That's going to happen. I mean, to the point where the fear is that since these giant healthcare insurers have us over a barrel so badly that you know, they can just charge whatever they want, and they're just driven solely by profit. They don't have any interest in our health other than not paying claims. I mean, they essentially what they're all about is how can they pay out as little as possible. They don't. It's not about how can they create the best healthcare. I mean, certain sector of the population has terrific healthcare, and as I said, access to great technology and skilled physicians and what have you. But the healthcare companies aren't interested in anything other than the bottom line, by definition, right?
Right.
So I have no confidence in them whatsoever. So I'll tell you, if we have no confidence in these big corporations and no confidence in the government, we are screwed.
Well, for example, there are programs out there that you don't have to go and, you know, have a, you know, what the public option reform that they're trying to do. Well, for example, I'm in college. I'm 20 years old. I pay for everything on my own. You know, no help from, you know, parents or anything. And my health care from the Washtenaw health plan before they cut it off was $15 a month.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And with that, I had, you know, the same copay as everybody else. I had, you know, $15 copay for ER. You know, my doctor visit was like $25, $50 or something like that. And that was supplied through Washtenaw.
Well, wait a minute. That's government.
That is government.
You're talking about just more localized. You're talking about more localized programs.
More localized program, exactly, which is out there now.
Yeah, but you know what you'd wind up with? You'd wind up with something good in Michigan and something that sucks, like in Alabama and Mississippi, as usual.
Well, I mean, one of the things that you can do is, like, well, as far as that goes, like, if they keep putting money into it, there's programs like this all over the place.
There is.
Not just Washtenaw. Like, I know what you mean, like, it's going to be sucky someplace else. Well, I mean, they can have a town hall meeting and, you know, use, you know, Ann Arbor as an example.
Well, they have, you know, plans like that in Massachusetts, in the city of San Francisco that wants to cover everybody. But, you know, like, all these municipalities are, pardon me, beginning to run short of funds. Like, apparently, Washtenaw did. TennCare in Tennessee just ran ran out of money. Same thing. So part of it is, that's why, you know, I think when I mentioned this stuff about the cost of the war, the cost of the U.S. embassy in Iraq, it's people are thinking I'm just, there's another bad thing. But it's all connected. If we're spending $1 trillion on this war that never should have occurred, well, what the hell? I mean, of course we don't have any money, right?
Well, exactly. But one of the other things that I was doing some quick math on while you're talking is like the $700 billion that they put out. If there's, you know, an exact 250 million Americans, and you were to give that $700 billion out to every American, including, you know, man, woman, and child all over, each person would be receiving 2,800.
Well, I would pick it up if I found it on the ground. But for one thing, it's not billion; it's a million. Are you talking about? Are you talking about the cost of the embassy?
No, the bailout money that they put out to all the other companies that were.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, listen. You know, things are a total mess, and one of the things that Barack Obama is doing is he's trying to operate within the system as he found it. I mean, it was, forgetting about the economy in general, was ruined by Bush and his stupid Reaganomics, he's too much of a centrist to do anything that's going to, like, revolutionize anything. So he's stuck trying to create these... these fix-its, these band-aids where there's hemorrhaging. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call, and I understand your concerns. Let's go to Tom in St. Paul, Minnesota. Tom, hi. Thanks for calling from so far away. You're on the air.
Well, good evening. It's always great to talk to you.
Well, thanks, Tom.
The whole reason that they're doing health care reform is because it's costing way too much. It's costing twice as much as it did 10 years ago. And that's, how are they going to get the cost down? But I think the simple thing is that insurance companies only add cost and complexity to
sure.
the system. They don't bring anything out. And we already have a costly endeavor. Medical care is costly. And it's already complicated. You know, it's even trying to understand one illness. Understanding, you know, the treatment of the common cold or the flu. When you're dealing with your own illness, there's quite a bit of information that you can find out about what the best practices are, what, you know, historically has happened. So if you take out the insurance companies, you've simplified what is already a costly and complicated system. And then you can, you know, we have the National Institutes of Health that determines, and the FDA, which are agencies that are supposed to determine what best practices are,
mm-hmm.
you know, what are good treatments for these things. And then you start sorting out the business with the providers, and you discover the doctors that are ordering tests because they own the machine, and they get a kickback of a grand every time they order a CAT scan. And so you can get into those. I mean, it's already complicated and costly. The private insurance system adds cost and adds complexity. They say, well, we want choices. Why? How can anybody want a different plan? If you have a plan that covers all accidents and all illness, and you're a human being, you know, that's all the plan you need.
Sure.
You know, I mean, you don't need a plan that's, have you ever read an insurance policy? They're always, you know, from these private insurance companies, they're always in excess of 100 pages. They don't make any sense. And if you want to compare two plans, then you have to read 200 pages and compare gobbledygook to gobbledygook.
No, I know.
This whole choice business is crap. There's one human, you know, there's one human being. And so you need one policy that covers all accidents and illnesses.
Well, you know, we have these critics on the right that say the Obama plan doesn't deal with what they finally admit is a need. In other words, they say there has to be health care reform. So where is their alternate plan? Okay, this one sucks. Where is the one that will, in fact, either keep constant or increase our level of care that we already have and create a price structure that everyone can participate in so that all are covered? I don't see that coming from them, that's for sure. It's
well,
not there.
You,
Because they really got to remember, and as we always say, there are conservatives. So essentially what they want to do is conserve everything as it is, because for all of their talk about freedom and Obamacare and fascism and communism and all that, they're really about keeping things as they are. And that benefits the huge insurers, the pharmaceutical companies, and the rest of these people that make a fortune off of our medical problems, or maybe when we don't have medical problems. What am I saying? Just the fact that, you know, fear against the cost of what would occur if we were to become ill or have an accident, as Tom says. So this is a system that, as usual, or a part of the system, as usual, that benefits solely the elites, and who pays the cost? You and me. All right, Tom, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. We got to take a break. Peter Werby here with you, Jalene Jordan as well. And our phone numbers are 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
If you'd like to call us, call talkyes@yahoo.com. You can look at my website and see some of the things we've been talking about at Peter Werby, PeterWerbe.com. We'll have a podcast up and running for you by noon on Tuesday. Why don't I just say I'm going to break? Everybody hangs up. Hey, there's open lines for you. 313-298-WRIF. We'll get you on the air.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
Hey, all you college football fans, would you like to win an ultimate sports den to watch your favorite games? If you think you know your X's and O's, click on the Taco Bell logo on your streaming player right now to try your luck at a game of tic-tac-toe for a chance to win a $20,000 ultimate sports den sponsored by Taco Bell. Plus, you'll find out instantly if you've won $20,000 toward the ultimate sports den you deserve. And five lucky people will be chosen at random to win $100 Taco Bell Bucks gift certificates. Click on the Taco Bell logo on your streaming player right now. Brought to you by Taco Bell.
Now's the time.
Now's the time to make a difference.
Now's the time to do what's right.
To help a family.
Now's the time to volunteer.
To make a commitment.
To make new friends.
To make dreams come true.
To help a child.
Now's the time to help Habitat for Humanity build hope and change lives with a family in your community or around the world.
Now's the time.
Now, more than ever, help build it.
Visit Habitat.org.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
Rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Angeline Jordan is with me, and we'll be taking your calls up till 1 a.m. and then airing a couple of interviews that I did previously. 2012, disaster or hype? 2012, the myths, fallacies, and truth behind the most intriguing date in history. John Major Jenkins, who is a expert on 2012. If you think of 2012, what the hell is that? You can Google that. Also, Thursday, we may be soon. I'm reading off my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com. Susan Marks, her book is Aquashock, The Water Crisis in America. Well, we're talking about this country. I mean, this is absolutely outrageous. The level of poverty in America is even worse than first believed. A revised formula for calculating medical costs and geographic variation showed that approximately 47.4 million Americans last year lived in poverty. And let's accept those government figures, which I don't for a minute, because right. When you start talking about what they expect people to live in a family of four, everybody in this audience would laugh. But let's say that. So that's almost 50 million people there. Can you imagine how many people that is? I mean, there's a lot of countries. I bet the majority of countries in the world do not have 50 million people in them. I think not. Canada doesn't have 50 million, do they? No. No, I think they're about half that or something like that. Also, then, what they have what they call the near poor. So what about the next 25 or 30 million people that really have to scrape to get by?
Yeah.
So you're talking 80, 90 million people, or probably close to a third of Americans live beneath the American dream, I would say. Here is what Richard Wolff said. He's the author of a new book, Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It. He said, since the 1970s, U.S. employers stopped paying their workers rising real wages, even as worker productivity kept rising. In other words, we were creating more through our work, more productivity, which gave them more money, except they didn't share it. They just took it all for themselves. Over the previous century, U.S. workers' real wages had risen together with the productivity. Workers then had two choices: give up the American dream of sending kids to college, buying good health care, enjoying retirement, living decently, or the other alternative, borrow to pay for those things. Desperate to live the dream, to be successful, to do what every advertisement advised, U.S. workers went on a 30-year borrowing binge. First, they borrowed with the collateral of their homes, if they owned homes. When that was not enough, the credit card industry arose to make unsecured, no-collateral consumer loans. By 2006, U.S. worker families had multiple members working multiple jobs and staggering under mortgage, auto, and credit card loans that their stagnant incomes could no longer sustain. What collapsed in 2008 was an American economy built on a good part on a house of credit cards because employers stopped paying rising wages for rising worker productivity. This is called looting, friends. In other words, the wealth that we created was looted from us. I mean, that's the nature of capitalism, period. But at different times, that those who don't own but who work for others, white collar, blue collar, what have you, were able to enjoy a standard of living that came about through the union movement, through social change, and what have you. But now it's looting like the 19th century. Whatever they can squeeze out of us, they do. The price of a college education rose substantially last year despite a 2.1% decline in consumer price index. And again, this is something, if we weren't spending trillions on war and preparation for war, that we could have free college education. So, with that, we continue on. This is Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. Here is Kurt and Warren. Kurt, thanks for your patience. You're on the air.
Hey, Pete, how you doing?
We're good.
I wonder if you remember me, maybe. I don't know, out of the billions of callers that have probably called you over the years. Back in around the middle of the 90s, I used to call, and I was a boat mechanic, and I was always mad because my boss was making so much money off of my time and paying me so little, and I just, you know.
There you go. Yeah, you're riveted in my mind forever, Kurt.
Well, I thought it might have kind of rung a bell, or maybe not, but...
Well, go ahead. What's on your mind?
Well, since then, I sure haven't seen anything get any better in the country as far as economy-wise and stuff like that. I did finally quit work for other
people.
Yeah, well, working for employers. I started working self-employed, basically.
Okay. How's that working?
Well, it worked good for quite a long time until the economy really started going down.
What were you doing? What were you doing working for yourself?
Same as I was doing before, working as a boat mechanic.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I just became freelance instead of working for a company.
Uh-huh.
And, well, with the 2001, you know, 9/11 and all that, you didn't see it right away. But we've really been seeing it since then, you know. What is it? We've passed the 8th or 9th anniversary or something of it by now.
Sure, the 8th, yeah.
Yeah, geez, it seems like it was just yesterday. I was sitting with my girlfriend watching Katie and Matt in the morning, and all of a sudden they came on, and we seen the planes flying into the thing. I says, wow, somebody messed up. And then when the second one hit, I go, oh, this is not a mistake.
So it really seems recent to you. I actually have the opposite feeling. Seems like
a million years ago.
Seems like it was
because of the 8 years we went through with Bush were so long.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, remember though when you were little and your mom said, "Oh, we'll be there in 15 minutes." You're in the back seat of the car going, "Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet?"
Yeah.
All day for 15 minutes to go by.
Yeah, that's well. That sure was the Bush year, as we said, "Mommy, when are these going to be over?" All right, Kurt, welcome back. Good hearing from you. Best of luck on your independent contractor work. Let's see. Here is Ethan in Auburn Hills. Hi, Ethan. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Great. I'm just calling in regards to the discussion you guys are having about the economy and problems that we have that we're facing and ways to prevent or to solve them.
Uh-huh.
And my initial one upon the terrorists in Afghanistan, you know, if we legalized marijuana, they wouldn't be able to send it over here. They wouldn't get our money for it. You know, the drug dealers wouldn't have any jobs.
Well, I think most of it may be grown hydroponically here in Michigan, but their big crop is poppy.
Heroin,
yeah. They provide about 375 tons a year for...
Like 60% of all the heroin in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the things, Ethan, that's interesting, the Taliban, they had stopped poppy production completely, but then when this Northern Alliance... And this President Karzai and these people, they restarted all the, you know, all the poppy growth. So I don't know, but I don't think too much Afghan hash is hitting the streets of Detroit. If they're still growing it, it probably just goes to Europe, because Europe they don't smoke any leaf. They just they smoke hash. So I've heard.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Okay. All right, Ethan, thank you. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Here's Daryl in Detroit. Hi, Daryl. You're on the air.
Hey, this is Darnell.
Darnell. Sorry.
I'm a long-time listener. I just always wanted to call the show.
Well, welcome.
Oh, great.
Yeah. What's up?
My question is, I wonder, do you think Barack Obama is doing a good job so far? Because I have, like, mixed feelings on it.
Well, I think most people that supported him, or lots of people that support him, have that sort of mixed feeling, that he ought to be a lot more aggressive in some of the things that that he's been doing. Like, there hasn't been a lot of leadership on the health care, to the point where we have a extraordinary, clear understanding of what he's trying to accomplish. Like, I don't have it. Do you have an absolutely crystal clear idea of what his health care plan is? I don't.
No.
Yeah, that's bad. That's not good. But
all right, but I wanted to give him at least more time before I really came with a decision. But
well, you know,
I'm kind of scared. I'm thinking, like, it's not going to come through. I'm thinking the Republicans and everybody's just going to keep blocking it. They're going to keep changing it. And then it's going to be pretty much what it was before or worse.
Well, I think he has so much to do, and he's only been in office for 10 months, right?
Yeah.
So
right.
I really think that people are expecting a little much, a little too fast, and yeah, he's going to toe that whole, you know, Democratic Party line and all of that and not do everything that, or as much as we all want him to do, you know, that's for sure. But anything's better than Bush or McCain or any of those other characters.
Well, I'll tell you, Darnell, the other problem is this Afghanistan thing, because he is just, well, I mean, the thing was true with Bush as well. Right now, Barack Obama is damned if he does and damned if he doesn't.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. There is no reason to believe that the introduction, I mean, I don't know what to say, think on that either. There's enough commentators that say that another 40,000 American troops aren't going to do anything. That the people of Afghanistan have this long history of resisting foreign invaders and occupiers. And
I mean, long history.
I mean,
history.
They defeated the Soviet Union. I mean, imagine that.
Yep.
And on the other hand, I was just reading this article that said boots on the ground will make a difference, and how the war could be won. But in any event, and what does that mean? I mean, what do we get out? We are occupying another country. We're going to spend tens of billions of dollars. The people all over the the Muslim world are going to have a deeper hatred for us. And what are we going to do? Just get right out? Let the Taliban back in? I mean, what a situation! No wonder he's taking a while trying to figure it all out. You know, Darnell, I'm almost out of time, so I'm going to cut you loose and welcome you to the show, and hope that you call us back when we have more time. Thank you. All right, let's see. Here's Eric. Eric's in Southgate. Hi, Eric. You got a unfortunately.
Mr. Peter and company.
Yes.
Yes.
We're down to just headlines now because we're getting towards the end of the show. So give me some quick comments if you would.
Well, I'm a $2 million man. $2 million has been spent in my name. I was in Walter P. Reuther, labor leader, for a month. It cost $30,000. I was on medication, Zyprexa, $1,000, $500 for the morning medication. That's $1,500 a month.
Wow.
Say no to public health care. If you want health care, just go to the hospital and refuse to pay the bill. I live in a trailer, and I got a little Mazar Sharif, John Sinclair, going. With love, John Sinclair, Michigan Haspass, Tappan Oak, 1858, Eric Edwards.
What? Whatever, dude.
Love John Sinclair.
Yes,
buddy.
Yes.
Good buddy.
Good health to you. Here is Ted in Ann Arbor. Hi, Ted. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Jolene. How are you guys doing tonight?
We're doing great.
Great. Hi.
Yeah, it's a little late me calling in. I usually call in a little earlier. Hey, what you're talking about, the economic boom, how they allowed us to live kind of like normal people for a while and then they come in and took it all, mm-hmm. That's called beekeeper economics. They allow the hive to thrive and fill the hive with honey, and then they come in and they just take all the honey and replace it with nothing, and we go back to work to fill the hive back up and get it all full of honey for them, and they just come take the honey.
Well, I like the analogy. The real problem was that the social movement that created the base for the middle class and our expectation of a continuing American dream was the union movement, and the leaders just got, they started living like the bosses. They didn't do any organizing. They thought this was going to go on forever. They let the deal go down, and now they don't have the social power that can do what's needed. I mean, we've got to create a new militancy among the middle class, among the working class, among the poor, to say, hey, you can't have guys that are having billions of dollars to get themselves in political office at the same time that we have somewhere between 50 and 80 million poor people in this country. This just doesn't fly. All right, Ted, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Let's see. Here is Jethro in Dearborn. Jethro, hi. You're on the air.
Oh, hey, Pete. You know what?
What?
I like Walter Reuther.
You like Walter Reuther?
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
We got to be the vanguard for all labor so the masses have the means to buy a car, because if they don't, they're not going to mass produce it. And when you go from 17 million vehicles down to 10 million vehicles, A lot of people are going to lose their jobs
and have
their homes.
Yeah.
It's bad news.
Well, I know. And on the other hand, can we ever have an economy of stasis, that is to say, equilibrium, where we don't...
Well, hold on.
What?
Sorry.
You got to go do something?
No. Automobile assembly lines, the wind turbine production plants.
Oh, okay. That's
we produce green energy. Hello?
Yeah, I'm all ears.
We produce green energy on a cost-plus basis, 4% profit margin. You know, come on. This should be done.
Well, I agree that it ought to be done more than just filling the world with millions of more cars. Because, that's the deal. I notice this. They say that the stock of companies goes down because they haven't increased sales performance over last year. Well, the idea that the people can consume endlessly is bad economics ultimately, and also it's disastrous to the planet. So yeah, wind turbines, all sorts of green energy, that's what we should be producing. I agree. All right, thank you, appreciate your call. Here's Nate in Redford. Hey Nate, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing, Peter?
We're good.
It's not that I really do not want to defend Bush, but I have a habit of playing devil's advocate.
Wait a minute. I'm the devil's advocate. How can you be the devil's advocate? He already gave the franchise to me. But go ahead.
When I was in school, we were taught that war has been historically beneficial to the economy of the country. And so it could easily be argued that with an economy beginning to fail, the decision was made, you know what we need is a good old-fashioned war. That'll get us out of this.
Well, we got a couple old-fashioned wars, but yeah, you know what? Sure. There used to be a saying, where was it? I forgot the guy that said it, that war is the health of the state, because people rally around the central... I mean, think about 9/11. I mean, Bush with 80% popularity, or not popularity, but support. But now, we're on a permanent war economy, and it's not working. I mean, it's sort of like drugs. You get high. Oh, man, that's the greatest high I ever had. Yeah, I need a little more. Ooh, I'm still not getting that buzz. I'm going to get a little bit more. Look, the only thing that got us out of the Depression was the war economy. In fact, we didn't totally get out of the Depression the first quarter of 1942, when the whole domestic economy, industrial economy, had been turned over to production to defend this country. And then in 1945, we didn't need it anymore. So what did we have to do? Oh, we found another enemy, the Soviet Union, so we could continue on a permanent war economy. You know, there's a great documentary that's available, I'm sure, most places where you can rent it. Thomas Video usually has a lot of these in Royal Oak. It's called Why We Fight. Why We Fight. And it begins with a statement.
Netflix. You can get it on Netflix.
Get it on Netflix if you have that.
By Thomas Video.
Thomas Video.
Yeah.
That's right.
Sport local.
All right, got to go home. Thank you, Nate. Another war. Oh, that'll do it. We can spend more money on it. You don't get enough bang for your buck is the problem with war spending. Sure, there's jobs. I mean, listen, there's we take all this money, this transfer of wealth, we take our tax dollars, and we spend $1 trillion so far in Iraq. Well, some of it just went to the Iraqis, hundreds of millions that we'll never even account for.
Yeah, but, get them to settle down a little bit.
Yeah, they
right?
go to, goes to weapons manufacturers who hire workers and all that. But the amount of money that government spending in other areas would provide is three times better. We wouldn't always be needing a war. All right, Jolene Jordan, thank you so much. Roger.
Absolutely. Thank you, Roger.
Thank you for doing the phone. Stay tuned.
As
got a couple
always.
Of great interviews.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Hey, all you college football fans, would you like to win an ultimate sports den to watch your favorite games? If you think you know your X's and O's, click on the Taco Bell logo on your streaming player right now to try your luck at a game of tic-tac-toe for a chance to win a $20,000 ultimate sports den sponsored by Taco Bell. Plus, you'll find out instantly if you've won $20,000 toward the ultimate sports den you deserve. And five lucky people will be chosen at random to win $100 Taco Bell Bucks gift certificates. Click on the Taco Bell logo on your streaming player right now. Brought to you by Taco Bell.
we got caught up in the crazy housing boom.
We had been in the house so long, we didn't want to lose it.
What these people share is that they all got in trouble with their mortgages, and they all called a certified housing counselor for help.
Our housing counselor looked at our paperwork, and she knew something was wrong.
She understood what needed to be done, and she helped me work it out with the bank.
This is a free service. Call the National Foundation for Credit Counseling now. Call 1-866-687-6322 or visit mortgagehelpnow.org.
Did I win?
Thursday.
Dude, are you serious?
All day this Thursday, exclusively from your walk right in free station. 101.
Who are you?
WRIF.
WRIF in WRIF HD1 Detroit.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. If you've been watching television lately, they've been doing these trailers for a film called 2012 with John Cusack. And some of you may have even seen, like I have, the five-minute trailer that's available online. Scared the hell out of me to the point where I thought, I am not even going to go see this film on the big screen. Essentially, it's the apocalypse. Everything crashes down. The whole world is destroyed. All the monuments crash. Millions and millions, everybody gets killed almost, I guess. I suppose John Cusack and his family make it out okay, but we'll have to see the movie. So what's the 2012 deal? Well, you may remember some time ago that I did an interview with Daniel Pinchak. He wrote a book called 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl. And 2012 is a key date in the Mayan calendar, and it's seen by many as the date of... Well, one cycle ends and kaboom, everything is destroyed. Or is it? That's what we're going to address, because I have another book, sort of a companion in a way, at least it's presented as such by the author, although the author is way ahead of the curve. In fact, has a book called Maya Cosmogenesis. 2012 was published in 1998. The author, John Major Jenkins, saw this occurring, and so he's been on this story a long time. The book is called The 2012 Story, The Myths, Fallacies, and Truth Behind the Most Intriguing Date in History. And John Major Jenkins is a pioneer in the modern 2012 movement. He's written 9 previous books on the subject, and one of what he's been trying to do is clarify all the misconceptions that talk about how a rare galactic alignment underlies the 2012 cycle-ending date, and this is embedded in the Mayan tradition. John Major Jenkins, as a visiting scholar, has taught at at the Institute of Maya Studies in Miami, the Esalen Institute in California, Naropa University in Colorado, a lot of other places as well. He's the director of the Center for 2012 Studies and moderates the update2012.com, which is a social networking information portal. He lives in Colorado. We are reaching him there. John Major Jenkins, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me on your program.
I was trying to clear up some of it, but this is so involved. Tell us, I don't know, give us the 2012 background, and maybe you could even start by, in a sense, summarizing your 1998 book, Maya Cosmogenesis 2012. How did that, did you and others discover the significance of this?
Yeah, that book was the culmination of the research that I did to reconstruct the origins of this long count calendar. That's the calendar that gives us this 2012 date. And I had to go and study and look back at the origin place of that calendar. And there's an early site, about 2,000 years old in southern Mexico called Izapa. And it's a fascinating site. There's carved monuments. There's, buildings that are oriented in certain ways to astronomy. And so my work has always been oriented towards trying to figure out what the ancient Maya actually thought and believed about this 2012 thing. And, of course, with all the excitement and hype about 2012 that's been growing since I first got involved in this about 25 years ago, there's so much hype around this that doesn't have anything to do with what the Maya believed. And that's another thing that I'm trying to sort of speak out with clarity now about a lot of that stuff that's going on.
Well, does the Mayan calendar suggest an apocalyptic end to everything, as we're beginning to hear? This is like Y2K writ large, right?
Exactly. Well, that's the sort of amazing thing, Peter, that there is no evidence at all that the Maya thought of cycle endings as apocalyptic Armageddon-type events. Maya time philosophy was cyclic in nature. They have this idea that at the end of cycles, humanity goes through a transformation and renewal, and it's never portrayed or presented in these kinds of catastrophic, apocalyptic terms. It's more, the onus is more on humanity in their spiritual teachings and their spiritual beliefs for humanity to make the sacrifice that's necessary in order to facilitate a transformation and a renewal.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned, I always think that it's important to identify people correctly by their names. Like, for instance, not Afghani people, it's Afghan people. In the same way, I'm saying Mayan, you say Maya. Is there should we clear up any language here, or is it interchangeable?
Well, I'm not particularly fastidious about the lexicon, the linguistics, the etymology stuff. It is technically correct. This has been sort of a point of contention among linguists that it's correct to say Maya for basically everything unless it refers to their language. So then you'd say the Mayan dialect.
Mm-hmm.
I've sort of adopted this just because I've been hammered by, the professional linguists on this myself. But I'm not particularly, fixated on that.
Well, John Major Jenkins, I'll go along with your sense of it all. Tell us about the Maya calendar, though. Obviously, they didn't identify December 21st, 2012, as the cycle-ending date. 2012 refers to how we date our modern calendar.
Yeah. Yeah, this gets into how the calendar was rediscovered by explorers and these different traditions of the Maya when explorers started traveling around in Mexico in the 1700s and 1800s, and then eventually finding manuscripts and these carved monuments that had these dates and glyphs. And early scholars had to figure out how this calendar works, and they did find a sequence of dates that was coherent and internally consistent. And then eventually scholars figured out how to correlate the long count calendar with our own. So we would have some sense as to, when these events were occurring that were recorded in the inscriptions. And eventually scholars did figure that out, and that's how we can look at dates in the long count. and correlate them with our Gregorian calendar. So we know that the end of the 13 Bakhtun cycle falls on December 21st of 2012.
The book is The 2012 Story, The Myths, Fallacies, and Truth Behind the Most Intriguing Date in History. John Major Jenkins is my guest. You can go to the2012story.com. There's a link to it. There'll be a link on my site as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com as well. Yeah, this is interesting because in every period of depression and recession throughout, and actually goes back into Europe as well, and perhaps around the world, when a people are unsure of themselves, when there's economic collapse, the war is lost, or what have you, people often have these apocalyptic views. Usually in this country, it's been the Christian end of the world, the returning of Christ. But do you think it's a coincidence that a movie like 2012 with John Cusack appears right now as in an era like this?
I don't think it's coincidence, really. I think there are dynamics that, you know, sort of happen as a culture evolves. I think the Maya did have insights into cycles in nature and the types of things that tend to happen towards the end of cycles. I think it's also important. I mean, that might be debatable. I mean, but I think that with the emergence of these movies and all this doomsday hype around this, obviously that's something that our own culture is insisting upon projecting onto this 2012 date, you know, because you don't find that kind of thing in the actual material. And I'm not saying that that's meaningless. We shouldn't say that that's meaningless or a hoax, although it is being made up by sort of exploitative outsiders who haven't really studied the tradition. It has meaning because it's sort of, it's like a projection screen for our own culture's deepest nihilistic fear.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps that serves a purpose in some way. If we can just project it onto the movie screen and then see it and embrace it, then we can purge it from our collective consciousness, and then we don't have to play it out in real terms.
You say in the 2012 story that about 95% of what we would find online if we Googled 2012, so we just get a lot of misinformation. Where does this all appear from? I mean, what's what's the genesis? You talk about cosmogenesis. What's the BS genesis of all this misinformation, disinformation about 2012?
Well, it is a topic that does push some buttons, and it plugs right into a lot of hot button stuff that exploitative writers are likely to pounce upon. So you have, you know, survivalist people that you can go to websites and buy gas masks or plots of land in South Africa, and so it's the perfect sort of carnival thing that people jump on that they think is going to be a hot thing to market. I mean, that's, in fact, it's not just popular writers or something that are exploiting 2012. It's also the marketplace on a big level. Even documentary programs that I've been interviewed for, I can't seem to shake them from their obsession with presenting 2012 in terms of doomsday.
Well, they probably think you're no fun, you know, it's sort of roller coaster-ish, if you will. You get, whoa, but then you have the feeling it's probably not really going to happen. Although in the film, as I said, the trailer, have you seen the trailer?
I've seen the film. I was invited to speak at the press junket that took place a couple weeks ago.
Well, wait a minute. John Major Jenkins,
talk
to us about this. This is incredible. What did you think of the film? I mean, let me just say, I saw the first 5 minutes and I thought, what are they going to do for the next 2 hours?
Right. Well, you know, I was invited to give a presentation on the real story, so it was very gracious of Sony Pictures to allow that. And I did meet the director, Roland Emmerich, and some of the actors. And, you know, it has to be said that Hollywood does what Hollywood does. It is presented as a sci-fi film, and I was expecting just a complete nonstop frenzy of apocalyptic imagery, which, in a sense, that was there. So if you're willing to sort of just allow the entertainment to happen, then that's fine. Of course, I do have a reflexive kind of problem with the premise, which is that the Maya predicted the end of the world in 2012. They certainly didn't. But I would say that the movie opens up. I mean, first of all, it is entertainment, so we can't, you know, think that this is an accurate representation of the Maya material. But it can open up some discussions around, you know, what would we do? How can we prepare to live a more fulfilling life on this planet? And so, you know, it has its redeeming qualities.
Hmm. And it's just supposed to hit the theaters, I think, in a week or two or something like that. We're talking, by the way, if you're just joining us, and I know sometimes on radio people get in the car and they thought, wait a minute, what are they talking about, the end of the world? My guess is John Major Jenkins. His book is The 2012 Story, The Myths, Fallacies, and Truth Behind the Most Intriguing Date in History, and that's December 21st, 2012. And in popular lore, this is the end of the Maya calendar and could be the beginning of this terrible, terrible catastrophes. And John Major Jenkins is saying this is nowhere near the truth, and not even embedded in the slightest in the Maya calendar. But you talk about this is going to be a date of which there is this, I have to quickly go to your book, the galactic alignment.
Yeah.
The galactic alignment. Explain to people what that is, and does it
sure.
have any significance whatsoever other than being maybe kind of pretty?
Well, I think that it is important to call out the BS, and I've been doing that for many years. There is a lot of hype that's going on, but I don't want people to throw the baby out with the bathwater. In other words, 2012 is a true artifact of the calendar tradition, and my work has been involved in reconstructing what the ancient Maya actually were thinking about. And I found that there's this profound astronomical knowledge that they were projecting forward to our era. They became aware of this slow astronomical cycle called the precession of the equinoxes. Now, this is not rocket science necessarily. It's just that, you know, our Earth wobbles very slowly on its axis, and one complete wobble is 26,000 years. It's real astronomy. It causes our orientation to the larger sphere of stars and constellations to slowly shift. So the galactic alignment is basically when the December solstice sun, the position of the solstice sun in the sky, shifts into alignment with the bright band of the Milky Way, the galaxy. That's why it's referred to as a galactic alignment, which often, you know, that's sort of taken as some kind of mystical mumbo-jumbo. But no, this is real astronomy. And this alignment is happening in the years around 2012. I talk about the calculations of astronomers on this, and I talk about a 36-year window. Now, I'm not implying that means that the galactic alignment causes pole flips or solar flares or anything like that. There's no evidence for that. But what I've shown is that the Maya incorporated this alignment image into this profound cosmology that they had involving their sacred ball game, their creation mythology, their king-making rituals. So in terms of just recovering this lost paradigm, which I've been engaged in, I think that's pretty exciting. That's pretty exciting stuff. It means that the ancient Maya were on par with their astronomical abilities with the ancient Greek astronomers at the same time.
Mm-hmm. John Major Jenkins, at the flap of your book, it says you're a pioneer of the modern 2012 movement. What exactly does it mean, movement? How is there a movement around the date of December 21st, 2012?
Well, I don't know. I think that that's kind of a funny characterization. I guess what I would say is that there is a movement to recover something of value that's been forgotten or lost. The long count calendar stopped being followed about 8 centuries ago. That's why it had to be reconstructed. Now, there are modern Maya people today who still follow the 260-day calendar, and there's actually kind of a movement or a renaissance, you might say, happening in Guatemala among the Maya people, in which the indigenous Maya people are taking on positions of leadership and power in the government, and I think that the movement generally, as it manifests in the popular culture, is that there's something missing from our own Western culture's values and policies in how we are running the planet. planet, basically. Mm-hmm. In fact, it seems like something's wrong, you know, and it's been leading us to this crisis with pollution and overpopulation and resource management, all this kind of stuff. And the movement, I think, believes that there's something in the Maya teachings or the Maya orientation to life that can help us redirect the trajectory of our own civilization and create a sustainable future. I think that's kind of the nub of it.
The book is by John Major Jenkins. Is the 2012 story, The Myths, Fallacies, and Truth Behind the Most Intriguing Date in History. And John Major Jenkins previously, you know, he's written numerous books, but his 1998 book was Maya Cosmogenesis 2012. He's been examining what we were talking about, sort of evolved into popular culture in terms of a lot of misconception. That's one of the reasons that this book is so important. And when you visited areas like Chiapas, actually the reason I knew there are Maya people there was because of that that revolution in the 1990s with the
Zapatistas,
yeah. but also in Guatemala and the highlands, a lot of Maya as well. They obviously are aware of this 2012 date, or when you were down there, how did you interact with them, and what significance do they hold for it?
Yeah, that's kind of a tricky question. I have lived and worked among the Maya on different occasions on my trips beginning in the 1980s, and the 2012 artifact, which is something that does belong to their heritage, there's been a disconnect in a sense, and so modern Maya people have had to learn about it from outside sources, and it's tricky because a lot of times those sources have been a bit confused, and you know, I don't know if the Maya people of today would actually look at, say, my reconstruction work and say, okay, we buy it, you know, but so the tricky thing is that even if my reconstruction work is correct, the modern Maya, if they're prerogative, they could get together in a council and say, nah, we're not going to buy that stuff. But I think that generally what's happening is that the Maya are rejecting the doomsday projection that is happening with Western culture onto what they are increasingly recognizing as their tradition. And if you look at the rituals that the Maya perform on cycle endings, smaller cycle endings in the calendar, because mm-hmm. they are still following the small calendar, you find that it's always rituals around facilitating the renewal, the transformation. So I think that's the key thing, and I think that's what's coming out right now in terms of what the Maya are saying about 2012, that it, like the small cycles, is like a big transformation and renewal, and there's something that we can be doing to facilitate that.
Now, that's a better thought than mass destruction or the apocalypse. Do you know where you're going to be on December 21st, 2012?
I don't. I hope I'm still around, I guess. Things
well,
are definitely
it's only 3 years. It's only 3 years, John. So.
3 years away, yeah. But things are definitely intensifying. You know, the tendency is to want to go to sacred sites, and I'm sure that that will be happening around the Americas, if not around the world. I talk about this in my book, The 2012 Story. In terms of a cautionary sort of advice that, you know, we don't want to be counterproductive to what we think this is about in terms of positive awakening or transformation, because 20,000 people descending upon the ancient Maya city of Chichen Itza could do great damage to the site as well as damage relations with the local people. So, you know, again, we need to just be careful of how we think about these things. But I'm evasive, I suppose, Peter. I can't say exactly where I'm going to be.
No. You anticipated my next. I thought maybe you'd say that's you were going to be at the sacred site, and then I was going to ask you what you mentioned here, a 2012 movement. I could imagine somehow 20,000. That seems small. I could imagine, you know, tens of thousands more showing up at all these Maya sites and the local people, the people that live there, all of a sudden. I always imagine, like, if you're listening here in the Detroit area and you live in Oak Park or Southgate or St. Clair Shores or something like that, all of a sudden, you know, you have 50,000 people in Southgate wanting to be near some shrine. It would kind of, they probably love it in the Detroit area. It would be, you know, good for the economy. But there, they're not exactly ready for large numbers of people.
Yeah, the infrastructure is definitely not in place at the kind, at the sites that I would probably think of as being the relevant sites to visit. And I kind of resist the whole idea of a huge carnival thing like that. I guess I'm kind of being a party pooper or something, but I'm sure that there will be others who are trying to, you know, sell the big end-of-the-world Mayapalooza event or something like that. But you heard it here first, so maybe they'll bring me in and I'll be, you know, hang gliding into some center stage and do a little jig or something.
Wow.
Like that.
Well, John Major Jenkins, we were discussing off the air before the interview, or at least I said to you, you're going to be pretty busy for the next 3 years. But actually, this is kind of a early run-up to it. I mean, we have 3 years away, and somehow, maybe, you know, you can call me back and tell me how wrong I was, but somehow I can't imagine this intense, at least say, you know, maybe right before it, a few months before, but I can't imagine that this is just going to go on, because it does have a carnival-esque atmosphere, and add to it the John Cusack movie, 2012, and it could peak early, don't you think?
Yeah, you know, and maybe that's a good thing. The movie is coming out next month, so there's this huge rush into the movie, and maybe peaking early is a good thing, because then we can sort of just purge all the incorrect projections around Doomsday and get past that, and then really look at the thing in itself, because that's really, to me, where the real story lies.
Well, we just have about a minute or so left. You talked about the idea not of apocalypse but of renewal, which is so constant in all the stories of pre-technological people, the necessity to you know, for a rebirth every spring, for instance, and here the end of a cycle, the beginning of a new one, and we need a new cycle to be sure. I don't think there's anyone who doubts that.
I'm interested in their creation mythology and how it contains what you might call spiritual teachings for cycle endings, and what I've written about in some of my books, and in this book in particular, the part two is devoted to this, is how their spiritual teachings in their creation myth, it's not just some vague mythology or fantasy, quaint myth or something like that. There's profound teachings in here, in the same way that you know, there's a comparative mythologist named Joseph Campbell who examined all of the world's traditions and found similar teachings in the religions.
Sure.
And so there's like a universal substrate, like an archetypal teaching that can be found in the creation myth that would apply to all people, and perhaps particularly to us, citizens of the cycle ending that the Maya had fixed into their calendar some 2,000 years ago.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. My guest has been John Major Jenkins. His book is The 2012 Story, The Myths, Fallacies, and Truth Behind the Most Intriguing Date in History. It's published by Tarcher Penguin. You can go to the website for the book, the2012story.com. There'll also be a link at my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. John Major Jenkins, thanks for having joined me on the program.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Tonight and every Monday night, join Meltdown and Sarah the Riff Rock Girl from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. for the biggest pigskin payoff party in the Motor City at Santino's on Van Dyke in Washington Township. One lucky person could win a cool $5,000 if the opening kick is returned for a touchdown. Enjoy drink specials and register to win plenty of riff prizes. Go to santinosbar.com for more details.
Hey, all you college football fans, would you like to win an ultimate sports den to watch your favorite games? If you think you know your X's and O's, click on the Taco Bell logo on your streaming player right now to try your luck at a game of tic-tac-toe for a chance to win a $20,000 ultimate sports den sponsored by Taco Bell. Plus, you'll find out instantly if you've won $20,000 toward the ultimate sports den you deserve. And five lucky people will be chosen at random to win $100 Taco Bell Bucks gift certificates. Click on the Taco Bell logo on your streaming player right now. Brought to you by Taco Bell.
These days, carrying a mortgage can overwhelm even the strongest person.
Don't I know that?
But there is a way to help ease your struggle, especially if you're facing foreclosure. One option may be advice from a certified foreclosure prevention specialist. It's absolutely free. Don't struggle. Learn more at www.makinghomeaffordable.gov. That's makinghomeaffordable.gov. Because foreclosure is not a foregone conclusion. A message from HUD in partnership with the National Fair Housing Alliance.
Every Tuesday, get double shots of the best riff rock.
The way you want it.
Rock. See, I told you there was a rational explanation.
Super Tuesday on 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks. Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Yeah, it's been said that nobody in Michigan lives more than 15 minutes away from water. And, of course, many of us live much closer. But water is an increasing problem for many, many people, not only in the United States, but certainly around the world, to the point where some people, like Michael Clare, have even suggested there might be wars over it. I think a good term for it is the title of a new book by Bloomberg. It's called Aqua Shock, The Water Crisis in America. The author is Susan J. Marks, and she's an award-winning journalist and author. She spent more than a dozen years at Denver Post, and she worked as the Sunday Business Editor and Special Projects Editor in Business as well. She also has written for Business Week, the Los Angeles Times, Forbes, a lot of other publications as well. She's received numerous awards and recognition from local, regional, and national organizations, and it's a pleasure to welcome her to the Peter Werby Show. We've got, as I record this today, 70-degree weather. Susan J. Marks, you just told me you got snow out there in Denver. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm shivering in a corner here with all the precipitation coming down.
Well, we don't, here in Michigan, we never think about water as being a problem other than at sometimes being too much or our water bills getting too high. But the Aquashock, the water crisis in America, I'll bet you a lot of people around here aren't aware that there's a crisis. How do you define it?
It's all of the above and then some. The water crisis in America ranges from everything from the fact that we have climate change and drought in many areas of the country to the way we develop our land that paves out Earth's natural ability to replenish its water supplies. We have pollution, both natural and man-made. We have people that move to where the water is not. The contributors to the crisis are go on and on and on, and as do the solutions to the crisis. There is no one silver bullet. I like to think that water is the oil of the 21st century. We have a growing demand, limited supply, and that's going to equal shortage and conflict over what's left. So
well, we can
have years about wars over water. That's not so far fetched. It's already going on.
We can do without oil. In fact, it would be great if we could. We can't do without water, can we? Everybody needs water. We're kind of stuck without.
The average human can only live about a week without water, and every other living thing on this planet requires water as the elixir of life too. So there is no silver bullet. We've got to have water, and we can't produce it because we use mind-boggling amounts of it every day. People don't realize how much water contributes to what we do. We use it to produce our energy, and not just hydroelectric power, but it's used for all aspects of energy production and delivery. We use it to grow our crops, feed our livestock. We use it to manufacture our goods. We use it to mine our resources, and then we have all our personal uses. The average person in the United States uses approximately 80 to 100 gallons of water every single day, and that's just for in-home personal use.
Whoa, let's back up and say that one again. Susan J. Marks, how many gallons, 80 to 100 gallons a person?
Approximately 80 to 100 gallons of water. Now, everybody's going to dispute the numbers depending on who's the numbers differ depending on who's counting, where they are, the climate, and they vastly vary. Obviously, an area with heavy precipitation where it's very moist, like in Michigan, you're more likely to use less water than we do out here in Colorado, where it's an arid climate. But the average, and it's a United States Geological Survey number. They say it's about 80 to 100 gallons of water a day. I mean, when you figure you use 8 gallons just to brush your teeth every day, I mean that's a
really?
You don't realize the United States uses 408 billion, that's with a B, gallons of water every single day. Every single day, 365 days a year. I can't even tell you. I mean, the numbers get so mind-boggling. They're so massive that we think that our resource is inexhaustible. You look out the window at the magnificent lakes, Great Lakes, and you think, oh, gosh, you know, we have so much water. We don't need to worry about it. Oh, yeah? Well, you know, in 2007, Lake Superior hit lows. I have a great picture, well, not great, but I mean, a very telling photo from Traverse City, Michigan. It was for Michigan Sea Grant, and it shows Lake Michigan with very low water levels. So, you know, I mean, we have a huge supply, but we have an overwhelming demand for this amount of water, too.
Well, I know that 20 years ago, people were concerned about beachfront property on Lake Huron and Lake Michigan, of it rising, and people had to put up seawalls and everything. And now, as you correctly said, the lake levels are dropping. And that was going to be one of my questions. Even if lake levels are dropping, I mean, this is, you know, the Michigan, the state name is the Water Wonderland. So crisis in Michigan, maybe Arizona, but do you still think we ought to be concerned here in our state?
Well, you know, the water crisis is not just quantity, it's also quality. I mean, you'll get people that don't necessarily agree with some of the studies that have been done, but I was looking at, you know, Michigan, the beach closings for pollution. and the contamination. I mean, in the news recently, have been all these gender bender fish. These fish that the male fish are picking up female traits from what they believe to be contaminants. You know, the New York Times is regaling us with all these different these past couple of months with all these different things. How much atrazine, that's insecticide, is safe in your water? I mean, there's all kinds of things. I mean, you're not going to go out and take a glass and take it and drink the water out your door.
No.
I mean, so it's not just quantity, it's quality. The Earth has what's called a closed hydrologic or water cycle. The amount of water within that cycle of our planet has been the same for eons, and it will likely be the same for eons more. But what is not the same is the demand for the water, the quality of the water. And as I say, I've had different experts tell me, and Aquashock tell me, that the planet itself is not short on water. It is the quality of the water and the fact that water is where the people are not, mm-hmm. so to speak. Hence, you have the Great Lakes Compact as a way to preserve, you know, to keep the Great Lakes water within the Great Lakes watershed, the Great Lakes Basin. So it's not just a quantity issue.
Well, I know, and this will be maybe a coffee spitter if somebody is driving and drinking their coffee, but we always say every glass you drink or, you know, a cup of coffee you've had, the water has been through three toilets already. That it's, you know, that it's then...
If it was just the toilets, we have the technology to clean that out.
But, the amount... I mean, you go up Lake St. the Detroit River to Lake St. Clair, and then up the St. Clair River, and there is this chemical belt in Sarnia, Ontario, that is just pumping out the crap that's landing on Lake St. Clair, where they have the intake valves for Detroit Water. But we're usually told that Detroit Water is pretty good stuff. But you know what? Let me do this. Let me reintroduce you. Susan J. Marks is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. The book is Aquashock, The Water Crisis in America. She's hitting it dead on about water quality, and we have to get to zero pollution everywhere, and right in our water basin of the Great Lakes, we have to as well. But what I'm always astounded at is places like Phoenix. Tell people the difference between some Great Lakes and like an aquifer, and how some people are draining the aquifers for their water.
Well, if you don't mind me, I just step back a second to pollution.
Sure.
You know, something else, what goes up comes down. That air pollution is going to eventually end up in our water, too.
Right, exactly.
So,
good point. That's
you know, you talk about Phoenix. I had one hydrologist talk to me about how he was struck by the contradiction of flying over Phoenix and looking down. Here we are, a huge city in the middle of the desert with nearly everyone with a swimming pool in their backyard, each holding tens of thousands of gallons of water. So we have a quantity issue in places like Phoenix, whereas we have more of a quality issue in places in your area. Although you can look at New Berlin, Wisconsin, right there. And New Berlin has a problem with quality as well as quantity. They use aquifer water. They've been using aquifer water for years, but it turns out that the aquifers or the wells are polluted with naturally occurring radium.
Yeah.
So they had to go to Lake Michigan to get water. They're also on an intercontinental divide, which means half of the city drains to the Mississippi River Basin, half drains to the Great Lakes Basin. So, you know, there's so many things that we don't even realize enter into to the water issue. I mean, aquifers, you talk about farmers and farming and aquifers. I mean, in parts of the Great Plains, what they call it, the High Plains Aquifer, many people confuse that with the Ogallala Aquifer. The Ogallala is a part of the Great Plains Aquifer, but whatever you want to call the aquifer that feeds the fields for their water needs, this is the breadbasket of America, and there are parts of that aquifer that have been depleted, have been drawn way, way down, some to the point that they're only brackish water, because when you pull, you take down aquifers 100 or more, you know, a certain length of a number of feet, what's left is just a brackish, a salty water, because of the fact that the water underground moves through the ground. It's not stagnant. So that's why you have some other place like radium. You have arsenic in your in the water in Michigan, in much of the water in Michigan, and even if it's just trace amount of arsenic. I just read the other day in the National Institutes of Health organization came out with a study that shows that that they're showing that even these trace amounts of arsenic that we think are not harmful, and they're as I said, they're naturally occurring. They believe now that it lowers the human immune system so that it can't fight off H1N1. So, I mean, it goes on and on. We just don't realize how important water is.
I just pushed my cup of coffee away.
is that cup of coffee from tap water? Is that from bottled water? Or is that purified water?
Well, we should even let's talk in a little bit here. We have some time here on the Peter Werbe Show. We'll talk about bottled water. Aquashock, the book by Susan J. Marks, has a troubling front cover. Tell us about the photograph there. What are we looking at?
I think it's one of the best covers on a book I've ever seen. It's a picture of the California Aqueduct, which brings water from water-rich Northern California to thirsty Southern California. And this is what the area they call Outer Los Angeles. It's going through the Antelope Valley, and it's bringing the water down to the L.A. area. Something that this brings up doesn't necessarily have to do with this particular aqueduct or canal, but it brings up something that the solutions to the water problems that we have are not unilateral. This California aqueduct is a concrete-lined aqueduct so that it doesn't have water seepage. There's another major...
How many miles is it long?
I don't have that off the tip of my tongue.
But it's got to be a couple hundred miles.
Oh, yes. It comes from Northern California, and it brings it down to Southern California. But what's interesting about how this particular aqueduct was built versus some of the others, another one that brings water to Southern California is what they call is the All-American Canal. And it used to be just a dirt canal, mm-hmm. but it brought water from the Colorado River all the way to Southern California. And it was along the Mexican border, and tens of thousands of Mexican farmers for decades relied on seepage from the canal for their livelihoods, to water their fields and things like that. It's not like they didn't stick a pipe in the canal. They simply used the underground water seepage in the aquifer. And then this year, the United States unilaterally decided, we're losing too much water. We need to concrete line this canal. So they dedicated the all new and improved concrete lined All American Canal. So now those farmers are out of luck. That points out one of the big problems we have to deal with water, and to avoid those wars you talk about. We can't move unilaterally about water. We have to take a big picture approach to all the problems and figure out what we have and how the highest and best use to use an appraisal term.
I think we could probably look at a couple of cultural pieces with new eyes. One, of course, is the famous Roman Polanski film Chinatown, which is about bringing water to Southern California. The other is the Milagro Beanfield War by John Nichols, I think it is, but there's also a film about it where that's what reminded me, where Mexican farmers in New Mexico were dependent upon irrigation. But, we hear a lot, Susan Marks, about like droughts happening in Georgia. Of course, now they're almost being flooded.
I read the other day that Lake Lanier is full for the first time since 2005. That's Lake Lanier being Atlanta's main water supply.
So is there, take this question in the best manner possible. So is there like a Chicken Little aspect to this? The drought, and then we say, oh, no, we're running out of water, and then all of a sudden it's filled, like Michigan is overflowing, and now it's down, and in 10 years it'll be up. Tell me more about the water crisis and why you think this is permanent.
Yeah. I'm not a scientist, so I can't tell you unequivocally, but the way I understand it, that climate change doesn't just mean drought. It means sometimes you'll get severe weather occurrences also. So the climate change that we're going through is doing different things at different times, different areas of the country. Many people, there are schools of individuals that feel that they can't predict anyway. Many people don't even believe we're going through climate change. They just say it's the natural ups and downs of and the changes in climate. I don't know what's right and what's wrong and who's correct and who's not correct, but I do know there are things that are happening. I mean, if you look at they do side-by-side pictures. There's some great ones out there. There's one of the Grinnell Glacier that shows the Grinnell Glacier in Montana in the year 1900. And it's, you know, the glacier's way down over this mountain and everything like that. Then there's a side by, this beside it, there's a picture of the same angle in 2008. There's no glacier. It's gone.
Wow. And that's not going to come back seasonally. That's
well,
for sure.
No, it's not seasonal. The other thing, I had one water expert along the East Coast tell me that whether you buy into climate change or not, the maple trees give up their sap 2 weeks earlier. Than they've traditionally done. So, I mean, something's happening. Now, what it is, I don't know. But all of these things all contribute to the water crisis. We need to take all these things into consideration and try to, you know, unfortunately, consensus on water is very difficult. You're very lucky that you live in an area, although I'm sure there's a lot of contentiousness regarding it. But you have things like the Great Lakes Compact. You have other organizations that in cooperation with Canada that look at conservation and all these kinds of things. That's very, very rare. There are people that will criticize the various agreements that you have. They're weak, they have no teeth or whatever. But the fact that you even have people sitting down with different, who have different vested interests, sitting down and talking about it, is phenomenal.
Well, you did hit one of the problems right on the nose, the International Joint Commission, which has overseeing powers of the Great Lakes, has called for zero discharge. And, of course, everything under the sun, from chemicals and sarnia, all these taconite tailings from mining in the Upper Peninsula and on and on and on, and all sorts of discharges into the lakes go on. So what we really need is our policy changes to have a real commitment to zero discharge. The book is Aqua Shock, The Water Crisis in America. My guest on the Peter Werby Show, Susan J. Marks. You can go to her Facebook page. Either look for Susan J. Marks or Aqua Shock. That's AQUA. I'll have a link on my site as well, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. Before the show, we mentioned first you have to do is accept that there's a problem. Some people say, oh, no, you're saying everything's terrible. Well, if things are terrible, we better get a good look at it. So we get a good look at it in Aqua Shock, The Water Crisis in America, and then we have to then move from there. What are solutions? And one of the things you mentioned, an area I hadn't even thought about, but Michigan's terrible unemployment rate, there's actually some jobs that could be created in connection with solving this problem. Am I repeating correctly our conversation?
Absolutely. I mentioned to you that I was on a panel with John Austin, who's a policymaker in Michigan, and John came up with the idea, and I think that he's absolutely right on, that water will be the great job generator of the 21st century, and it's also the opportunity for tremendous entrepreneurship. When you think about that, among the problems we have with our water are infrastructure issues. I mean, you have all these water main breaks everywhere. That's because we have, one of the reasons is because I was just looking at before the show, I was looking at some of the many water main breaks that have occurred in Michigan here recently in your areas. There are tons of them. Kalamazoo, Flint, Plymouth, Ann Arbor, Superior Township, Jackson, Kalamazoo again. And Detroit, I mean, the water main breaks are the result of our antiquated infrastructure in many cases. There's 700,000 miles of pipes that crisscross underneath our cities and towns, and many of them are crumbling and worn out, and that's why you have, that's one of the reasons you have some of these water main breaks. They have to be replaced. Some of the price tags on that are $1 trillion or more to replace those. You have outdated, we talked about the pollution, the 20th century water treatment plants aren't built to take out 21st century pollution, so we have traces of all these different kinds of things in our water supplies. I mean, those have to be replaced. Technology can invent new ways to deal with a lot of these things. So American ingenuity it's right for people to think of ways to deal with the problems. Water is I can't even fathom the amount of money that will have to be spent related to water in the next 100 years. I hate to use the word, but it's mind-boggling. So, yes, it is a job generator and an opportunity for individuals to come up with ideas to solve the problems.
That means getting our priorities in order. How are we going to spend money? And if we're going to keep continue, this is, may seem a little off subject, but we're going to continue to fight wars all across the country and having an enormous military infrastructure, I don't think we can afford these other things as well. So there's probably going to have to be some choices. I just noticed this conversation is so intriguing to me that time is a flying. We only have a few minutes left. Usually there are things that each of us can do and that businesses can do. And one of the main things, of course, is turn the water off as much as possible. What areas would you look for?
Well, not just turning the water off, yes. I mean, think about it. The big part, one of the biggest hurdles to get over to solve the problems are to first recognize, as you say, that the problem exists. Recognizing that the problem exists, if we as individuals recognize it, then, you know, you might not leave the water on when you're walking away to do something. You know, that, believe it or not, that will save money. I mean, you fix your leaky faucets. I mean, there's a great drip accumulator that the EPA has on its website. It's incredible how many thousands of gallons one single drip amounts to in a year's time. I've had people tell me that, you know, zero is a very low number as far as your water footprint or whatever, and maybe it's not achievable, but, you know, if we pay attention to it, we can accomplish a lot. Something else to think about, instead of washing your car at home, everybody, that's a fun thing to do. I grew up in the Midwest, you know, that was one of the great fun things to do, but you don't think about that. That's actually washing pollutants into, forget the amounts of water you use, that's washing pollutants into our source water, because that, what they call, it ends up being part of what they call non-point source pollution, that just stuff that finds its way in there, and that's all kinds of greases and chemicals and whatever that are on your car from the road.
Yikes, that's what I was going to do. It's a nice 70-degree day here as we record this, and I was going to go home and wash my car on the drive. Now I'm scratching my head.
You know, go to a car wash. I don't represent the car wash industry, but the car wash industry, you know, they most of the time recycle the water and reuse it. It saves some water. You know, wash, take one less bath. That's like 50 gallons of water per bath. You know, try to take a smaller shower. Here in Colorado, they're getting better at doing this. They reuse water. That's their great future, with reusing water and developing new ways to reuse water. Oftentimes golf courses will be, or developments, outdoor irrigation will, non-potable water, non-drinkable water.
Rain barrels are interesting. You know, people think, a friend of mine got a rain barrel at her house, and she said she thought it would take about maybe 10 rains to fill it up. Like one rain, the thing is overflowing, because what happens, all the water that's come down on the entire surface drains into the barrel, and there you go. You got your water for your garden.
But here's a coffee spitter, too. You better be careful where you live when you do that, because depending on how your water is dispersed, how it's allocated, the laws of the land, of your particular land, in some areas where they have prior appropriation, which is a form of water allocation, that's against the law. You do not own that water coming out of the sky.
That's amazing. I've seen that recently. Some people have been arrested. This is all good, and I think what was that guy, used to be the vice president? Oh, yeah, Cheney. Cheney said, he would say these are mere gestures, but gestures can be important, because it begins to show a recognition and a realization of what we're facing.
Yes, that's the best thing. I wrote Aqua Shock. I don't have a personal agenda. I'm a journalist, and I don't work for a environmental or anti-environmental organization. I simply wanted to shock Americans with the reality that we are running, we have problems with water, and we need to pay attention to some of them. And we have problems that we don't even know exist yet, and we have solutions that cause problems that we don't even know exist yet. So, I mean, I know that sounds crazy, but, you know, everybody touted desalination. That's, you know, taking the salt out of the seawater and drinking it, and purifying and then drinking it. But the desalination creates its own problems. There's leftover brine that's very salty, and they've discovered in some studies will show that some of that brine that they put back out in the sea upsets that ecosystem.
Well, we're going to have to actually leave it at that. And and you can tell, I think, by the passion that my guest, Susan J. Marks, has, that of the amazing amount of information that she has marshaled in her book, Aqua was shocked, though, the water crisis in America. You go to her Facebook page, just look up Susan J. Marks or Aqua Shock, A-Q-U-A, or you can go to my website as well, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. It's published by Bloomberg Press. That's Bloomberg.com/books. Susan J. Marks, thanks for alerting us. Thanks for your book, Aqua Shock, The Water Crisis in America, and thanks for being on the broadcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate your time and your interest.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Hey, all you college football fans, would you like to win an ultimate sports den to watch your favorite games? If you think you know your X's and O's, click on the Taco Bell logo on your streaming player right now to try your luck at a game of tic-tac-toe for a chance to win a $20,000 ultimate sports den sponsored by Taco Bell. Plus, you'll find out instantly if you've won $20,000 toward the ultimate sports den you deserve. And five lucky people will be chosen at random to win $100 Taco Bell Bucks gift certificates. Click on the Taco Bell logo on your streaming player right now. Brought to you by Taco Bell.
Hello?
Hi, I'm calling about the two-bedroom apartment you advertised. Is it still available?
Sure.
Great.
Unless you're black or Latino or disabled.
Housing discrimination is rarely this obvious, but it's just as real and just as illegal. So if you hear things like,
I can't assign you a handicapped parking space,
that could be housing discrimination. And the only way to stop it is to report it so we can investigate it. Visit hud.gov/fairhousing or call HUD's housing discrimination hotline at 1-800-669-9777. A message from HUD in partnership with the National Fair Housing Alliance.
Did I win?
Blitz.
I won?
Thursday.
Dude, are you serious?
All day this Thursday, exclusively from your walk right in free station. 101.
Who are you?
W-R-I-F.
Streaming live and pop-up free since 1997 at WRIF.com.
What you really, really want.
101 WRIF.
And WRIF, HD1 Detroit.
Everything that rocks.